Good morning, and welcome to the Huntington Ingalls Industries 2015 Investor Day. I'm Dwayne Blake, Vice President of Investor Relations, and we thank you for taking the time to join us in person or to listen in via the webcast. For those attending in person, in the event of an emergency, please note that the exits are located through these doors on my left. So today you will hear from Mike Petters, our CEO, Barb Nyland, our CFO, Mitch Waldman, who runs our Washington office, and our segment presidents, Matt Mulhern, Brian Cuccias, and Philip Luna. They will address a number of important topics relating to the next 3 to 5 years for Huntington Ingalls Industries. After each of the segment presidents' presentations, there will be a 10-minute question and answer session, and we will complete the formal portion of the day with a panel Q&A session. Again, for attendees in the room, following the completion of the panel Q&A session, lunch will be served in the Hubbard rooms. Throughout the day, forward-looking information may be disclosed or discussed. As always, this information is subject to risk and uncertainties as outlined here and detailed in our SEC filings. In addition, reconciliations to non-GAAP measures are included in the appendix to the presentation that will be posted on our website. Now it is my pleasure to welcome our President and Chief Executive Officer, Mike Petters.
Well, thanks, Dwayne, and good morning to everyone. First of all, I want to thank each of you for being here today and taking time out of your busy schedules to find out more about who we are. I see some folks out there that know an awful lot about us, but I suspect there are some folks in the room who are wanting to find out more about us. And so our hope is that we're going to immerse you in the business today in a way that maybe even if you followed us for a while, you haven't really seen all that we're going to talk about today. So we hope it's worth your time. For those of you who don't know me, I've been in this business now for 28 years, and I actually have been involved with nuclear ships since I was in the Navy going back 33 years now, I guess. So it's been a great vocation for me and have seen a lot, have learned a lot, and I am privileged to work with the best team in the industry, and you're going to get a chance to hear from them today as well. We're going to start the morning with a video to try to give you a sense of who Huntington Ingalls Industries is and what it is that we do and what's so cool about our business. And so as a means of getting this conversation started, we're going to go ahead and start a video here.
Hard stuff done right.
And, you know, it's
pretty exciting to be in a business where every morning when you wake up, you just can't wait to get to work and try to tackle the next big. You don't know what's coming, but you know it's going to be a fun challenge, and you're going to get to work through some really really interesting things. Let's talk about our key messages for today, and to kind of put the summary of what we're going to do this morning up front. First of all, back in 2011 when we spun the company off, we told you where we wanted to be by 2015. We told you we were going to have to retire a lot of risk, we were going to have to work through some execution issues at our Ingalls business, and that we were looking for sustainable performance and constant performance at our Newport News business. And we're here to tell you today that we did that. You know, we actually, not only did we sustain our performance at Newport News, we created efficiency and performance at Ingalls that really drove the value of this company over the last 4 years. And in fact, as we retired our risk, we were able to start to initiate our shareholder distributions earlier than we might have thought back in 2011, the first time that we talked with you. In the interim, we've also done a couple of acquisitions that have, I think, significantly enhanced some our capabilities and created new channels of contact between new customers and some of the great capabilities that we have in our business. The thing that's true about our business that has not changed and is not going to change under any foreseeable future for this business is the partnership that we have with the Navy. It's unique in that wherever the Navy is, we are there with them. It's unique in that our investment in our capabilities has an effect on how successful the Navy can be in some of their strategies, and it's unique in that it's a long-term, way over the horizon kind of partnership, and so it's hard to imagine any future for this company where that partnership is not central to who we are. It's also somewhat hard to imagine any future for the Navy where their partnership with us is not central to who they are, and so. So we're very proud of that, and we're going to continue to work on that and invest in that, and we will never, ever take that for granted. The third thing I would say, and I alluded to it before, is that we have, in my view, the best leadership team in the business. Most of the leadership team that's in place today actually began working on these challenges together going back to our Northrop Grumman days. We have some folks who have come along since then who have been great additions to the team, but we've been doing this for quite a while. We have a proven team and a proven track record, and what I love about the team is that when we set our eyes on an objective, everybody pulls on the rope in the same way to get to that point. And finally, what we're going to talk about today is a little bit about what we've done, but mostly about where we're going. And our objective today is to give you some sense of what you can expect from this company, not in the next quarter. You know, those of you that know me know that I will tell you that this is not a quarter-to-quarter company. But we're going to try to give you some clarity on those things that you can expect us out of us over the next 5 years or so and how we think about the future of this business and the future of our capabilities. At a glance of who we are, we're the premier U.S. Navy shipbuilder and U.S. military shipbuilder doing work for both the Navy and for the Coast Guard and the Department of Homeland Security. Our two principal shipbuilding businesses are at Ingalls and at Newport News. At Newport News, we have 129 years of history there, and at Ingalls, the young kid on the block, we only have 77 years of history at Ingalls. And so that creates a very deep relationship with our customers, but it also creates a very deep relationship with our communities and with our workforce and with all of those other stakeholders in what we do. At Ingalls, we do our non-nuclear shipbuilding. We support the Coast Guard program there in the national security cutters. Brian's going to talk about that some more today. We do destroyers, and our amphibious ship programs are done at Ingalls. At Newport News, we do our nuclear shipbuilding. We do the carrier construction, the submarine construction, and the carrier refuelings and carrier inactivations. And so you can think about that as the two principal parts of our business. We have added capability and bandwidth into the oil and gas sector through UPI, and Philip Luna is here today representing that as the president of that company. You see that on the chart here in the other section. That has greatly expanded our list of customers, and so as we align our capabilities to more and more customers, we think that that's going to create new value for our business over the long term. We are a $7 billion business, and as you can see, in last year, we generated $655 million of EBIT. So this is kind of who we are, 37,000 employees, 5,000 engineers and designers. Our headquarters is in Newport News, but we are actually located all over the world, and I'll talk some more about that. Now, we talk and think about our business as being a shipbuilding business, and you probably think of us as a shipbuilding business, and what I'm excited about today is you're going to get a chance to see a lot of what we do kind of below the level of the shipbuilding business in terms of our service and support. You know, in the we kind of think of this now in four areas. Clearly, shipbuilding is front and center, and Newport News and Ingalls are part of that. Our acquisition of the Undersea Solutions Group is also part of enhancing our technology and capabilities in shipbuilding. But we have a pretty robust government services business in AMSEC, supporting the Navy around the world, and Continental Maritime, a repair operation in San Diego, which facilitates our support of the Navy in that important harbor. In nuclear operations and environmental services, we acquired the SM Stoller organization, which created a lot of access to the Department of Energy for capabilities that are resident in Newport News. And Newport News Industrial is a company that we've had and have operated for a couple of decades in support of the commercial nuclear power business. We are actually doing construction and fabrication in support of commercial nuclear construction in the U.S. today. And, of course, as I mentioned, the oil and gas space, the access to the customers and the space that's there, we'll talk some more about that as well. I want to talk, first of all, about these first two areas, DOD and DHS shipbuilding and government services. And I want to show you a map that shows you where not only where the Navy is, but where we are in support of them. Now, this really just shows this is not where the whole Navy is, but this is where the aircraft carriers are and where the large amphibs are. So these are their big parts of the Navy. Big fleet actions, big exercises that are going on. And you see in these the logos, that tells you where we are permanently stationed to support them. You know, there's the old expression that the sun never set on the Royal Navy back in the day. Well, the sun never sets on HII today because we are around the world in support of our Navy customer providing fleet support. What you don't see on this map is our Tiger Team capability to go support the Navy, even in places where we may not have a cadre or an office. And so places like Bahrain and Kuwait and, you know, and places like that where the Navy is operating are places that that we are routinely sending people in support of what the Navy is up to. And so, again, we don't talk a lot about this in the short interactions that we have with you because we end up talking about what's happening in shipbuilding and what's happening in Washington to support shipbuilding because that's the big driver of our business. But we think that this is, over the long haul, we think this is actually going to be a great opportunity for us to continue to partner and support our customer. And when you look at this map and you start to count up where the carriers are and what they're doing, you know, what I see going on today in Washington, I think Mitch will talk some more about this, is today what we're seeing is we have a 15-carrier world, and we have 10 carriers to support it. And so we're trying to make 10 carriers look like 15, which creates a lot of maintenance requirements. It creates a lot of high-tempo operations, which means there's a need for a lot of support. And so our view is to partner with the Navy to go and make that happen. The other side of our business in nuclear operations and environmental services, we're very pleased with the way these have, particularly in the nuclear place, how this has worked itself out. You know, we acquired SM Stoller almost 2 years ago now. And what we had at Newport News was we had significant environmental and nuclear operating capability. In fact, DOE felt felt that we were best in class in those categories. But what we didn't have is we didn't have access to those markets. I mean, we were doing some work in Savannah River on a team with Fluor and Honeywell, but there was a lot of opportunity in the DOE, and there is a lot of opportunity in the DOE. We didn't have the customer intimacy and relationships at Newport News to go and to try to build on that. On the other hand, Stoller is a company that's sitting on about 20 or 25 DOE sites, has great access to the DOE, and really was looking for the bandwidth to support that, the staff to support the operations that they had there. So this is an opportunity for us to take our capability that we use every day in shipbuilding and create a new set of customers and new access for work that's coming down the pike in the Department of Energy. Matt's going to talk some more about what we think those opportunities are and how we plan to prosecute those. And as I mentioned, NNI has been doing fabrication in support of the commercial nuclear industry for quite a while. And where we are today, as the new plants are coming on in construction down in Georgia and South Carolina, we've been working with those, with the utility and with Westinghouse and with CB&I to work our way through how do you reconcile the design and the fabrication requirements that the NRC has and what the utility is going to require and how do you bring that to fruition. And we found that that's one of those hard things that there just isn't anybody out there to do, and we're pretty good at it. So we're working, and we continue to work through that manufacturing piece for commercial nuclear. In the oil and gas space, we went into that space with the same idea that we had with Stoller, that we would expand our access to a set of customers, create channels to our capabilities. I've told you that I've already admitted that I was the only person not to know that the price of oil would go down. So when we went into that space, we did not have that prospect in front of us. We have been working our way through, and Phillips and his team have done a really good job of trying to keep in balance the capabilities that are required to support those customers that are there and the relationships that we have that are there with the fact that the work has gone substantially down. And we continue to work our way through that, and we will continue to work our way through that because we do believe that there is a point in time where this business will turn. And access to our capabilities from that industry is going to be an important part of our story. Our leadership team, we've talked about the folks here in front of the room. Brian and Matt and Philip are the business unit leaders. You all know Barb really well. Barb has announced her pending retirement, which we congratulate her on, but we're really sad to see. But Chris Kastner is here in the front row, and Chris has been, elected to be the CFO. He's kind of the CFO in waiting right now. I think that just as an aside, I would point out that I think this is one of the things that we actually do pretty well, and that is the development of our leadership team. And Barb stood up a team here to go and do public company business management and finance 4.5 years ago, and in the process created a pipeline of leaders that are ready to continue to carry this ball forward. So not only creating a team out of whole cloth to go and do that as well as she has done, but she actually has created a team of folks that can carry on long after she's gone. And we're going to really miss Barb, but somehow we'll hold it together. And Chris and I will do the best we can. Along with Chris, we have Tom Steele and Mike Helpenstiel, who are the business unit financial leaders for Ingalls and for Newport News. And so they're here to provide moral support and to answer your questions should we stump the panel here in the front of the room. In addition, we just brought on in the last year, Kelly Walker has come on as our new general counsel. Kelly comes to us from outside of the Department of Defense and brings to us a whole different set of perspectives on how public companies can operate. And so that diversity of idea and perspective is something that we really value, and we're glad that she has decided to join us and excited about our future together. And Jerry Deseski is here also, who handles our communications and handles all of our communications from the corporate level. So this is the team, and this is the team that has really been carrying this water Like I said, not just from 2011, but most of this team has been carrying a lot of the shipbuilding water that we've had to go through since 2008 when we first put it all together under Northrop. Let me take you back to 2011 for a minute. On this chart, on the let's see, on the left side of this chart, your left, are the exact commitments that we made when we came out to you in March of 2011. This is what we said we were going to do, and I just would ask you to take a look at that and acknowledge that we said that at Newport News we were going to protect and strengthen our market position, and we were going to go and capture new business. And without going through all of the points on the chart, let's just take those green arrows to say, and we did that. You know, we have done what we said we were going to do, and we've done that not by with a lot of hand-waving, but with a lot of really hard work, a great partnership in an environment that has been probably less predictable than any of us kind of thought would be in 2011. Between the ship deliveries, the new awards, we've been able to keep our submarine build rate going, getting the ORP off to a pretty healthy start. All of those things are what we said we were going to do. At Ingalls, as I said before, you know, Ingalls was really the, in 2011, Ingalls was all about, did we get the operating system right, and would this really be able to drive value in the business? And I think that you could say now, today, looking back with the 2020 perspective of hindsight and say, that's a resounding yes. We had that right. We were comfortable with it and confident about it, confident enough to spin the company out of Northrop Grumman. I know that you know, I've had some conversation with some of you who were skeptical is not the right word, but just wanting to make sure that we knew what we were doing. And I think the results are there, and that it's clear that we've been able to do all that. We have delivered all of the underperforming work that we had laid out in 2011. We have gotten our programs there in serial production. Brian's going to talk some more about what's going on in the yard today, about the different classes of ships that are being built there. But it has been a remarkable effort by the team at Ingalls. And I think that it has been, you know, I don't want anybody to take it for granted, because there's been a lot of long hours trying to make all of this happen. Getting the 51 program restarted, getting the facilities right-sized between Gulfport and Avondale, all of that, any one of those is a tough challenge. And putting all of that together, that team has done a remarkable job. So, as we said, we told you what we were going to do in 2011, and we told you where we thought we'd be in 2015, and our point today is that we're here. We said we'd be here, and we are here. And so today what we're going to do, without taking too many victory laps over what we've done in the last 4 years, we really want to talk about what's going to happen next and where are we going. And we think about our company, we think about from the standpoint of what's next for our company, you know, overriding everything is our objective to achieve the full potential of this business. You know, waking up every morning and looking in the mirror and saying, am I achieving my full potential as a leader? Is the business achieving its full potential as a business? That's a really tall bar for anybody to live up to, but that's our aspiration, and that's what we're after. When we think about our competencies and what we're good at what in today's world, all of our businesses are particularly good at engineering and program management. We do heavy manufacturing for the Department of Defense, and we're best in class at nuclear operations at Newport News. When we think about the markets where you can apply that to, you know, it's obviously the DOD and the Coast Guard shipbuilding programs is one market that we've traditionally been involved with. Government services, we actually have probably more of a footprint in government services than many of you may realize, and you're going to hear more about that today. We think that there's real opportunity to expand in government services, and we think that there's opportunity to expand our nuclear operations and environmental services business. And our presence in the oil and gas business is in a place where it allows us to position ourselves to maintain the relationships that we have with key customers there and be ready for that market when it turns around. And so with that as introduction, I hope that you'll find this a very informative day. I'm going to come back up at the end of the day and kind of wrap it all up. But I'm going to turn this over to the folks who do all the work now and start with my partner for the last, I guess, Barb, you and I have worked together now for 12 years, right? 10 years anyway. And so I don't know who's going to be kicking me under the table or rolling her eyes at me after she's gone. But anyway, I'm going to turn this over to Barb and let her take you through the next section. Barb, thank you.
Thanks, Mike, and thanks, everybody. Good morning, and thanks for joining us. So I don't have, like, a great video, and if it was, it would, like, say stuff like pension and lots of numbers or maybe a Rubik's Cube or something, right? But I'm going to kind of take you through a little financial review here. So I'm going to start with our financial results. So Mike talked a little bit about this already. You know, when we spun the company, our commitment to everyone and ourselves was to get this business into a healthy 9%+ segment operating margin by the end of 2015. As a result of the great partnership with our customers, as well as our talented workforce, we progressed towards that goal earlier than we ever anticipated, and we are continuing to track to that goal. So we've had, with our improved operating margin performance, we've generated some really nice improved free cash flow, too. So because of all that, we've been able to strengthen our balance sheet, and as Mike said, we were able to initiate shareholder distribution earlier than expected. So let me show you a few of the metrics. We talk all the time about shipbuilding business being a flat business, and you can see from a revenue perspective, very little growth over the last 4 years, and we continue down that path, steady eddy, but very long horizon business, which is an advantage that other customers don't have. So when you look at the earnings per share, you can see that we had told you that our focus was on margin expansion at Ingalls, as well as continued steady performance at Newport News. So we were able to generate that margin expansion, and as a result, we had a 280 basis point improvement since 2011, and with that came significant EPS growth. So overall, continued to perform as we said we were going to do. So turning to free cash flow generation, for those of you who have followed us or listened to our earnings calls, I have a famous word about cash, and that's it's lumpy. So I finally have been able to put together a chart that shows you it's true, it's lumpy. So what I have also told you, though, is if you look over a long period of time, so say a 3 or 5 year period, you will see that we do have 100% or better free cash flow conversion. And so I show you that here on the right. I talk about the lumpiness. It's real. There's a lot of things that affect that. So it's timing of ship deliveries. It's timing of ship construction milestones. It's timing of completion of warranty periods. And then the other thing that affects us is we don't have thousands and thousands of contracts out there, but at the end of the month, we'll have a dozen outstanding invoices, and one can be worth $50, $60, $70 million, so it becomes timing of customer payments. And it's not day sales outstanding. It's just the fact they didn't pay us on the 30th of the month. They paid us the 2nd of the following month. So there's the facts. So backs up what I've been talking about. When you look about the balance sheet, or look at our balance sheet, we've strengthened our balance sheet over the last 4 years. We've taken a lot of actions to improve our liquidity and also to give us financial flexibility. We refinanced our 7-year bonds, and recently we refinanced our 10-year bonds. And as a result of that, we have lower interest rates as well as better covenants. We repaid our term loan this past year, and we increased our revolver availability. All of these actions, combined with our improved performance at Ingalls, allowed us to improve our credit rating from BB minus to BB plus, and you can see we have no debt maturities over the next 5 years. So overall, I think we've done a very good job in addition to the performance on the ships and everything, but getting us into good financial shape. When you look at our strong financial or our strong cash generation, on the left side, you see their cash from operations, $1.3 billion over the last few years. This slide actually focuses on 2012 through 2014. I didn't include 2011 on this because we didn't begin our shareholder distributions until 2012. So I just wanted to show you during that period of time how we've used our cash from operations and our free cash flow. So the pie on the left, it shows the total picture here. And we have invested in our business through capital expenditures and improving our facilities and maintenance and sustainment of those facilities. We've done a little bit of acquisitions, and then we have returned cash to shareholders. On the pie on the right, actually breaks out a little further, excluding the capital investment piece and the investment in our businesses, you will see that we've had a relatively balanced cash deployment strategy over the last 3 years, and a greater portion of that cash going to our shareholders. The next slide I have is to show you how we've done as far as our return on invested capital. And what you can see is that our returns have exceeded our cost of capital. So we did have 1 year, it's a little low, in 2012, and there was a lot of moving parts there, including some tax true-ups that we had to do with Northrop Grumman at the time. So that kind of pushed it down a little bit. But overall, we've been very good stewards as far as returning return on invested capital. So in summary, we have significantly improved our financial performance over the last 4.5 years. We've had strong free cash flow generation, and it allowed us to make shareholder distributions earlier than planned. And we strengthened our balance sheet, and it positions us for the future. So with that, I will turn the presentation over to Mitch Waldman, our Corporate Vice President of Government and Customer Relations, who will provide you his thoughts on the environment in Washington.
Thanks, Barb, and good morning, everybody. I'm Mitch Waldman, the Corporate Vice President for Government and Customer Relations. As I like to tell folks, I'm the guy from D.C., and I'm here to help. I'm honored to lead a team in Washington, D.C., and work very closely with my colleagues here on the panel, Matt and Brian and Philip, and the balance of the management team to represent really the broad range, the entire range of interests of Huntington Ingalls in Washington. We do things in three lanes. People like to think about the Washington team, oh, you guys are the lobbyists. That's about 25% of what we do. We really do things in association with our customers, with the Congress, and looking forward. And really, with our customers, we interface at a very senior level with the Navy, the Defense Department, the Coast Guard, Department of Energy, and other federal agencies. We work closely with the Congress, congressional members, and staff members on legislation and policy that affects not only the things that we build, the products and services that we provide, but also the processes and environment in which we do business. And lastly, we focus not just on today's issues and challenges, but the future. We work with our customers and think tanks and academic institutions and trade associations to understand where the puck is going to be, as I like to say, to contemplate future trends in technology, customer requirements, and business practices. So in a summary, what we do in Washington is we translate Washington East into Shipyard East and Shipyard East into Washington East, and we do it in all three domains. So Mike talked about a 10-carrier Navy and a 15-carrier world. I think the other thing that I talk about is a 34 amphib Navy and a 54 amphib world. And what does that mean? If you have kids, you always talk about needs versus wants, and it's no different in Washington. Lots of needs and lots of wants, and the challenges to balance the requirements against the budget. So I always start with the budget. And that's what we have on the right-hand side of this slide here. We call this the hash chart. This chart gets pretty messy, actually, over time as you kind of look at the moves that the Pentagon is thinking about and the Congress is thinking about. But this is the baseline. And if you notice, the green column is the 2016 President's Budget Request. And I'll go through that in a minute, and I'll walk you down, essentially in linear fashion, from top to bottom, our perspective on each of those programs. But the goodness about the budget, the President's Budget Request for the Department of Defense and the Coast Guard, is they not only give you the one-year view of the budget at hand, but a five-year view, which is actually very, very good because you get a perspective of things that are important to us, like serial production, continuity, learning across ships. And so we look most importantly at the budget at hand in the green column this year, but then also going to the right, how the programs are shaping up over the balance of the five-year plan. So again, this is the budget that the President submitted last February. We call it a President's Budget Request because balance of powers in our government. We have the executive branch that makes the request. We have the Congress, a co-equal branch of government, that disposes, authorizes, and appropriates dollars in support of those respective programs. So going down the list here, you can see in 2016, the intent to build the next carrier, CVN 80, the Enterprise, we like that name. That's in 2018, as well as refuel and overhaul two carriers. That's the RCOH line, the George Washington in 2016 and the Stennis in 2020. The planned purchase of DDG-51-class destroyers and Virginia-class submarines at two per year, continuous serial production of those ships. Serial production is very good for shipbuilding because you can learn and reduce cost and get very efficient ship over ship year after year. That's good for the business, and that's good for the customer. Production of LPD-class ships continues with the addition of LPD-28. I spoke with some of you about that last night. The LPD-28 is in the President's budget request. There have been 2 years of previous funding in 2013 and 2015 for that ship, and Congress granted incremental funding authority for that ship. But the fact that the President's budget request included it in 16 said the Navy wants to buy that ship, and that's a very good thing. LPD-28 will also help bridge to the future LXR class. That's the follow-on amphib. And the Navy has decided that that LXR ship, which on this list is shown as a 2020 ship, I'll talk about that in a minute, a bit more detail, it's going to be based on the LPD hull form. And so that's also good from Huntington Ingalls' perspective, since we're very familiar, obviously, with LPD-class ships. The budget also requests the next big deck amphibious ship, LHA-8, as well as the next generation of fleet oilers. Those are the TAO class ships. You may be aware that the competition for that program has begun. It's going to be a simultaneous competition limited to only Ingalls and NASSCO for those ships, and where each shipyard can only win either the LHA-8 or the first six TAOs. The Ohio class replacement remains the Navy's top priority in the shipbuilding plan, but there's a progressive increase in funding for R&D as well as procurement funding, advanced procurement funding across the five-year plan. And so again, the investment is there that shows a commitment to build the Ohio-class replacement. And as Mike said, that's really a strategic priority for our nation. Regarding energy programs, investment in the environmental management program remains fairly steady at about $5 billion a year. We have a portion of that in the work that we do. This type of funding supports effort at Savannah River and other nuclear waste management sites that we perform. We also pay close attention to policy changes, recommendations that may flow from the Quadrennial Energy Review. Funny to hear a shipbuilder talk about that, but we focus a lot on energy and infrastructure, particularly for pipelines and offshore platforms. So that's the perspective from the executive branch. This is what they asked for. So then the question is, what does Congress have to say about that? So I'm going to give some general observations. Oops. I really jumped forward, didn't I? There we go. What does Congress have to say about that? So the challenge of a brief like this and the pace of Washington is always interesting. You develop your slides, and then remarkably a lot happens in about 2 weeks. So I'll use this general language to talk through where we are today in terms of congressional progress. But the overarching comment is this, that by and large, the Congress and the committees, the defense committees and the other committees that support shipbuilding, strongly support shipbuilding. And in fact, in many cases, they increased investment and support above the President's budget request. So that is good for the shipbuilders of this nation.
the recent budget compromise, this is where the changes happened over the past few weeks, the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2015 provided temporary relief for sequestration by raising the budget caps in 2016 and 2017 for defense and non-defense discretionary accounts. Now, we're hopeful that these budget levels in the Budget Act have paved the way for revisions to the 2016 National Defense Authorization Act. You may be aware that that revised act that was originally, the original act was vetoed by the President, came back to the Congress. They didn't bother to go down a path of trying to override that veto. What they did was we had the Bipartisan Budget Act occur, provided budget levels, and so the Congress took the approach of let's just revise the Authorization Act to reflect those budget act levels. So the House passed that bill last week by a vote of 370-58, pretty substantial. And then the Senate is actually scheduled to take up that bill today, and I suspect it will pass overwhelmingly there as well. It's only an up or down vote. It's not an amendable bill. So hopefully by the end of the day, we'll have an NDAA that is approved. We're hopeful that the budget agreement will enable the passage of appropriations bills. There will be lots of dialogue about that, not necessarily about the substance of the defense bills itself, but the riders, all these policy riders that may go on the bills, and that will be the item for debate. But we're hopeful that by the time the current continuing resolution expires on December 11th, that we'll have appropriations bills finished and the fiscal year can get moving forward with full force. So setting aside all of that churn for a minute, I'm the D.C. guy, so I look for macro trends in terms of what the Congress is focused on. And I really see four, and I'll talk about these in a minute, but I see the concept of evolution of mature programs. For the past decade or so, various programs have been maturing, Virginia-class submarines, DDG-51, and in fact, the aircraft carrier has done a very good job coming together and will serve as the basis for future carriers as well. So evolution of platforms, acceleration of platforms. If you remember the President's budget request slide, some programs are derivatives of current ships that are under construction, and yet there are several years of gap between the current ship under production and future ships. There's a dialogue in the Congress about how do you move those two things closer together and really glean the efficiencies of continuous production from a current production line to something in the future. So acceleration is the second theme. Serial production obviously flows from that. How do you make a cookie cutter as best as possible, minimize changes? And then the last point is how does the government buy these things, this whole issue of acquisition reform and accountability. So congressional defense committees generally supported the evolution of existing platforms, as I said, like DDG-51, LPD-17 class amphibious warships, Virginia-class submarines, to meet future fleet requirements. For example, the next iteration of DDG-51 class ships, known as DDG Flight 3, will have a new radar and other upgrades to counter emerging threats. The next block of Virginia-class submarines will have a payload module to carry cruise missiles. There's interest in accelerating LXR and LHA-8 to enhance program affordability to help and help remedy a shortfall in the size of the amphibious warship fleet. That's the 34 amphibs in a 54 amphib world, comment I made earlier. Congressional Defense Committee has also supported purchase of CVN-79 and CVN-80, but they also focus on affordability and capability of future aircraft carriers. Continued serial production of DDG-51 class destroyers, Virginia-class submarines, and amphibious warships was recognized as a very efficient way to leverage and sustain hot production lines and supply chains. And finally, as I said earlier, there's interest in improving the way the Defense Department buys things in the acquisition process to better balance affordability, capability, and risk, and also clarify program accountability between the Defense Department and the military services. So shifting to the executive branch in terms of observations, as they look to the future, many of these same concerns, many of these same issues are a focus of the executive branch, particularly embraced by the Department of Defense, Department of Navy, Coast Guard. They want to facilitate stability and predictability in shipbuilding programs in the plan. They want to address force structure challenges and achieve a better balance of affordability, capability, and risk. So you can see there's tremendous overlap, actually, between what the executive branch wants for shipbuilding defense programs and what the Congress wants as well.
But the overarching theme right now is executing under the current continuing resolution that, again, goes through the 11th of December until appropriations are hopefully enacted. And then moving forward with the 17 budget, there's this process, train is always moving forward, right? The process of 16 to 17, and in fact, their budget bill for fiscal year 18 has actually started already. So these things are very much intertwined. So they're going to move on with building the 2017 budget to the new budget caps. But I just want to reiterate, you know, sequestration is only in remission, as I call it. This budget deal was for 2016 and 17. So sequestration looms for 2018 and beyond unless a long-term budget deal can be reached. So I've talked about the current president's budget, talked about the Congress, their adjudication of that budget. I want to talk a minute and finish up, really, on the concept of a long-range plan. So we talked about the five-year plan, but in fact, by law, the Navy is required to submit annually a long-range plan to the Congress that covers a 30-year time period. Not bad. Mike talks about quarter over quarter, not really being us. Well, the Navy looks at it over a 30-year period, and we're happy to understand that as well. So they project the construction and retirement of ships. But the purpose of this plan, it's a very interesting quote if you go back and refer to the 2016 plan. The structure of the plan is to meet national security strategy requirements and maintain a healthy industrial base. So they do look at not just the ships that they want to build, but the implication of building those certain ships on the industrial base. So I'm going to focus on that embedded table on the left-hand side to your left and kind of walk you down again in linear fashion from top to bottom. So again, this is a 30-year look. So I've listed the broad categories of ships on the left-hand side. Talked about the average unit quantity of each ship type in the middle, and that kind of fluctuates a bit over time. And then I want to talk about a snapshot of how we, Huntington and Ingalls, participate in each one of those programs today. So the total force structure number down the bottom there, I don't know how well you can read that, it says 308 total ships. And that's at some point in the future, kind of a notional average of 308 ships. We're a little bit below that today if you look at the fleet today and where they're dispersed. But the target of 308 essentially is reached over a period of time. It's a little bit higher than last year. It was 306 last year, and that reflects the addition of LPD 28 and one additional support ship. So as you can see, kind of going down the right-hand column here, HII percent participation. HII is the sole provider for construction, refueling and complex overhaul, and inactivation of aircraft carriers. For Virginia-class submarines, we're team 50-50 with Electric Boat. We compete, that's what capability means, we compete in the submarine overhaul market. And for SSBN, I know I had some questions about this last evening, the Ohio-class replacement, how we participate in construction is under consideration by the Navy with the recognition that the submarine industrial base that produces the Virginia-class will be called upon to produce the Ohio-class program. For DDG-51 destroyers, we compete for a quantity of ships that are allocated to both Ingalls and Bath Iron Works. Regarding small surface combatants, we're not building any of those for the Navy today, but we are building them for the Coast Guard in the form of national security cutters. And we're also pursuing international opportunities for similar frigate-sized ships. HII builds 100% of the LPDs and LHAs today, and as I mentioned earlier, we're currently engaged in a competition for LHA-8 and TAO. And for LXR, we obviously have the capability to compete for construction of those ships since it's based on the LPD hull form. For combat support ships, the next one in line, the TAOs, we built the previous class of TAOs, the Henry J. Kaiser class, terrific class of ships, and we have the capability and expertise to do that work as well. So while the number 308, as I said before, kind of stays relatively constant. There are fluctuations year over year in the specific ships that comprise that number, but by and large, this is the force structure, the mix of ships that our nation will have, that we will have, that our children will have for the next 30 years. So those are the numbers. Let's look at it from a budget perspective. The Congressional Budget Office reviews this plan every year. They submit a report to the Congress every year on the affordability of the plan, and to nobody's surprise, they always conclude that the plan is underfunded, pretty consistent, usually about 6% underfunded in the near term and 14% or greater underfunded kind of in the long term. So not surprising. The reality is, as the plan progresses, that long-term becomes the near-term, and the delta of budget versus requirement closes over time. So historical, again, delta of about 6% pressure in the near-term from CBO's perspective. But this plan is unique in that this is the first time that I can ever remember where the plan itself, in the cover letter from the Navy to the Congress, explicitly acknowledges that the funding required to execute the plan in the 2020s exceeds historical levels, and that's predominantly due to the Ohio-class replacement program, the strategic imperative for our country. The good news is both the legislative branch and the executive branch are already talking about this. They both recognize the funding challenges that exist in the future and how vitally important it is to satisfy those funding challenges for our nation. And finally, I'd be remiss, and it's not on the chart, but I'd be remiss if I didn't mention President Obama's recent trip to the Arctic, where he highlighted the need to accelerate the purchase of new heavy-duty icebreakers. A heavy-duty icebreaker is a ship about 400 feet long and can plow through at about 3 knots, 6 feet of ice. So you think about the scale of that ship. It's quite remarkable. Huntington Ingalls built the last medium-duty icebreaker. It's not as robust as the heavy-duty. It can only plow through 3 feet of ice versus 6 feet of ice, but we obviously have a skill set to do that work as well, and we believe we have the capacity to compete for that work going forward. So in summary, regarding the 30-year plan and the 5-year plan, near-term 5-year plan appears to be well-supported in the budget. Programs leverage mature programs that we're already involved in. There's some dialogue to accelerate programs to better sustain production lines and supplier lines, and that's a good thing. And the 2020s are going to be a challenging time, but by the time we get to 2020, being a D.C. guy, I have confidence that the nation will work its way through these challenges. That completes my presentation. I'd now like to introduce Matt Mulheron, Corporate Vice President and President of Newport News Shipbuilding, who will provide an overview of that segment. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much for being here. As was said, my name is Matt Mulheron. I've been at the shipyard since for almost 35 years. I came in June of 1981. Just as an aside, I figure I'd stay there a year or two till I figure out what I wanted to do with my life. I'm not sure I figured that out yet. So it is a pleasure, though, to be here and talk to you about Newport News Shipbuilding and the subsidiaries that I manage every day. So what I'd like to do is, Mike showed a video of a lot of the cool stuff we do. One of the things I want to show you is a video of the people. So this is an excerpt of a video. We have a President's Model of Excellence Award, and this is awards given to a very, very small percentage of the workforce for people who have demonstrated, you know, fantastic leadership capabilities, solved big challenges, either individually or as a team. So let me just show you that video just to get a perspective of the workers of Newport News.
It's really hard to put into words because it's amazing to see what is accomplished here. There is no simple task, and everybody's job is important.
It just blows my mind some days when I sit back and I really think about what we do here in the shipyard.
It's all about teamwork, of course. If everybody does their share and you put your minds together, you can accomplish anything.
If you can't be proud about what we do here, you can't be proud about anything. We're not making golf balls. That may be a little bit harder to be motivated about, but when you come in and you see the carriers and submarines we build, it's really easy to be proud about your contribution to the country.
I truly enjoy getting down into the weeds, digging through problems, and finding out what the true solution is. I don't do it for recognition. I do it because I love what I do.
It's amazing to me to see that 100,000-ton ship sitting there in the water and it's floating. And it's all because of all these people that are here every day. They put their heart and soul into this place just to do that, so we have a great defense system for our whole country.
Think about that all the time. I'm thinking they're out there fighting for our freedom, so we can come in to work day in and day out to do what we do to support them.
Just coming to work, doing what I do best, being excited for what I do best. I think that's, you know, part of the integrity of what we're brought here to do.
You know, you want this to keep going. And I think all of us have to understand that we have to take ownership in that, that we're committed to make this happen. To me, it's not a job. When you've been here this long, it's really your lifestyle. And it consumes a lot of your thinking and a lot of your time. But let me tell you, at the end of the day, when you see a ship leave, you see it launch one, you see one go around the coal pier, it's very rewarding.
You got a quick snapshot of a handful of great shipbuilders. So Newport News Shipbuilding at a glance, what do we do every day? So we are the sole provider of provider of nuclear-powered aircraft carriers to the United States Navy. Today, that's done with the Ford class, where we're building and coming to completion on the Gerald R. Ford and just starting on the John F. Kennedy. We also are the sole provider of midlife refueling overhaul services for Nimitz-class aircraft carriers, as we are the sole provider of inactivation services, the defueling and the inactivation of nuclear carriers. We're one of two who build Virginia-class submarines and are part of that submarine industrial base going forward. And we are, with the acquisition of the Undersea Solutions Group, we are a designer and builder of unmanned underwater vehicles for both domestic and international militaries. We are a provider of ship repair and fleet services for naval ships throughout the world, a component fabricator at a Newport News industrial facility for commercial nuclear power plants. We have capabilities to operate, manage, maintain DOE site facilities, as well as provide cleanup services in that same industry to remediate sites. We do all that as Virginia's largest industrial employer, and you can see at the bottom the revenue numbers of a little over $4.5 billion, operating income of about $415 million, and this is all in 2014, with an operating margin of 9.1%. Currently, our backlog exists at about $16.4 billion, and we have a slide that shows you some of that. We employ about 24,500 employees, of which a very large percentage are the highly skilled, highly capable designers, engineers, but that shouldn't take away from the rest of the workforce of Newport News, an amazing bunch of folks. Headquartered in Newport News, Virginia, in fact, we predate the foundation or the forming of the city of Newport News, so I'm not sure who, I guess that's where they got their name from us. And in January 28th of 2016, we will become celebrate our 130th year of operation. So you can see, a lot of stability in the industry and time in doing this work. You look at the financial review. We talked about revenue and operating margin as being relatively flat and stable and predictable. You can see that on the left. Segment backlog has certainly grown to a high today of about $16.4 billion, largely with the award of the CVN-73 refueling planning contract, the Block 4 Virginia-class submarine, and the contract for CVN-79 detailed design and construction. So as we talk about a long horizon business, and you get to see that very predictable out there in the future. So let's talk a little bit about each one of our programs and what are we doing on the aircraft carrier side of the business. Certainly last night, a lot of questions about Gerald R. Ford. Gerald R. Ford is about 95% complete, delivering the first half of next year. We are completing those technologies. You know, I believe everything you read, so what I'll read to you or show you is the October 2014 Navy Times, and it says best ship ever, so I think that sums it up without any more conversation about Ford. Moving on to the next ship, the John F. Kennedy, we laid the keel for Kennedy on August 22nd of this year. We laid the keel 6 weeks early. The ship is doing well to budget and schedule, and that ship delivers in 2022. And there was a lot of that conversation last night of how do you learn those lessons and translate that from Ford into Kennedy. we're doing, not just, and we talk about it in two ways. You've got to learn those lessons and do it better, but you also have to do things differently to get the savings that we need, that the Navy needs, and the nation needs. Next, moving on to aircraft carrier refueling overhaul. Think about this. This is a ship we deliver 23 years later, almost to the day, the ship shows back up at Newport News Shipbuilding to really have three principal jobs done. It gets the propulsion plants refueled, obviously, as the name goes. It gets the entire ship recapitalized, so it is ready to go out and do the nation's business for the next 25 years. And then it gets completely modernized. Warfare systems, all those capabilities get upgraded to the latest and greatest. Today, we're in month 31 of 44 months on Abraham Lincoln. The ship has come in, been refueled. It is out of dock. It is actually coming to life. The ship is, we're steaming the propulsion plants and making great progress for a 2016 delivery next year. Second ship we want to talk about in the aircraft carrier refueling overhaul is the George Washington. Typically in this business, you're executing one refueling overhaul while you're planning for another. George Washington got a little bit mixed up in that there was a view at one time that ship, instead of a refueling overhaul, it would be inactivated and taken out of service. That has been rectified with the help of the Congress and the Navy. It is now planned to be a refueling overhaul, and we are deep into her planning. And planning really kind of mischaracterizes the effort. That is all the engineering, long lead time material procurement. It is everything but going down and physically starting work on the ship. The ship should start. It is on its way from, this is the ship that was forward deployed in Yokosuka, Japan, well on its way. The first of this month, it was coming around through the Straits of Magellan, coming around South America, on its way to Norfolk, Virginia, to be the carrier in Norfolk for some period of time before it actually comes into the yard in 2016. So we have a little bit of a gap between the delivery of Abraham Lincoln and the arrival of George Washington. So we're working our way through that. And lastly, aircraft carrier inactivation. At Newport News, we don't like to do simple tasks, so we picked the hardest one first. We picked the aircraft carrier with 8 reactors to go inactivate and defuel. The fact that she was 52 years, probably had years old, had something to do with that. So the ship is in the yard. We are actively going through the inactivation process and getting her ready for the actual dismantlement phase here that starts after we redeliver her in 2017. So what you can see from a redelivery standpoint, we talk about the workforce perturbations that occur at Newport News because of nearly, in aircraft carrier terms, nearly simultaneous with delivery of Ford, Abraham Lincoln, and then Enterprise. So we've had some reductions in force this year, and we have talked about greater than 1,000 publicly that could occur next year. So we're working our way through that. We have talked to the workforce, but I tell you, we are seeing some opportunities in our ability to go support work over at the Navy bases and around the world, getting some more fleet support work. So there is some opportunity. Submarine program, I think I'm here telling you guys a lot about what you know, but you can see the pictorially on the top, the view of the submarine. What's in green, Newport News Shipbuilding builds. What's in blue, our Teammate Electric Boat builds in kind of a 50-50 teaming arrangement. So I build the bow and the sail. I build the stern of the ship. EB builds the pieces in between, and I build some modules, whether they're habitability, auxiliary machinery rooms, the torpedo rooms, the weapon system platforms. Those are the pieces I build. You kind of in the middle, you get a chance to kind of see those four big sections on either end. Pretty amazing you're able to go, and it's kind of a daunting view to see the stern or the bow of a submarine being driven around on these multi-wheel transporters in the yard as you come around the corner and look, and that's what's facing you, and it's traffic jammed to say the least. but it gets these get put on a barge, transferred back and forth between ourselves and our teaming partner in a pretty amazing and very well thought out co-build process. So where we are, Block 3 submarines, 8 submarines. We delivered our first, the SSN 785. That was the John Warner. We commissioned that ship in August 1st of this year, a great ship, and we will deliver our last, the SSN 791, our last Block 3 submarine in 2019. So that was in Block 3. We transitioned to two submarines a year. We are fully at the two-per-year pace from a manning, from a supply base, from everything is fully now at a two-per-year pace now that we've delivered our first ship. Moving on to the middle block, the Block 4, that's 10 submarines. That continues building Virginia-class submarines at the two-per-year pace. The first four boats of that 10-ship block are under construction, and you can see we deliver our first in 2019. Our last boat of that block in 2023. Then Virginia-class submarine Block 5 is expected to be awarded in 2019, likely or potentially a nine-boat block of submarines, and there is obviously a lot of talk that it will include the Virginia payload module. With the converted SSBNs have been converted to SSGNs, that give you a lot of missile capability, cruise missile launch capability. That capability is coming down from a submarine launch capability. So the Virginia payload module gives you four missile tubes to be able to that will be part of a Virginia class submarine to help maintain that vertical launch capability. So it may be incorporated, and you can. That's what's kind of that middle piece. You can see the four tubes kind of goes in the. Back after in the kind of the center of the ship as it gets designed. You can see the deliveries range 2024 to 2025. We're kind of in the making the donuts phase of this thing. It's just it continues on, great performance boat after boat. The Navy gets the value of kind of competition, and I'll put that in quotes, just it is the natural competition. Electric Boat delivers a submarine, and they get it's in a time frame, a cost, and an in-serve score. And my goal is to do it faster, do it cheaper, and get a better in-serve score at the end of the day. And that's where everybody benefits. So, Virginia class submarine program going extremely well. So that's really kind of the shipbuilding piece, if you would. So we get into the Navy services piece that we provide. Really multiple pieces, and you can kind of see across the bottom the logos of various companies. So Newport News Shipbuilding certainly is in the Navy services piece. AMSEC is a company, is a subsidiary of about 2,000 folks who provide logistic maintenance, modernization, training services to the Navy. Then there is a Continental Maritime piece of this business. Continental is a small 500-person shipyard in San Diego right under the Coronado Bridge that provides a lot of services to San Diego Harbor. It's a master ship repair certified company, and we do work on aircraft carriers and surface ships, amphibs, destroyers, and the like. And then lastly, on the far right, is with the acquisition of the Undersea Solutions Group from Columbia Group earlier this year. That's where we have capability now to marry up with our submarine engineering and construction folks. We have this unmanned undersea capability that comes with the USG folks to be able to give us an opportunity to compete in that LDUV business. You know, as I think about Newport News Shipbuilding's involvement, it's largely as kind of an OEM, an original equipment manufacturer piece. You know, that is the big, heavy, long-duration availabilities that requires lots of engineering planning, supply chain work. And then there's also a piece of that that is largely, planning yards for the various classes of ships that we're part of. So all great stuff, great opportunities for us. and gives us an opportunity to truly expand what we're able to provide there in that that piece of the business. Likewise, we have an energy services, nuclear energy services business. You know, when I think about it, the nuclear management and operations piece is really an outgrowth of what we do every day at Newport News Shipbuilding. We manage a large industrial facility, a large facility that does nuclear work, and we every day bring systems, ships to, you know, kind of bring them to life with assembly test and delivery type capabilities. So that nuclear management and operations is largely, you know, kind of what Newport News Shipbuilding brings. We bought the SM Stoller Corporation, a company that really provides environmental services and remediation services, largely in the DOE business. We really saw some synergies there, so we took our Newport News Nuclear organization with Stoller, and we created this Stoller Newport News Nuclear SN3 organization that is out there competing today. We're part of the maintenance and operation down in the Savannah River site, partnered with Fluor and Honeywell. So we continue to find work and go after work in that that whole DOE business segment. As you look out into the future, there's over the next 5, 6, 7 years, there's about $60 billion worth of effort out there that is certainly worth going after. On the far right-hand side, Newport News Industrial. Newport News Industrial just celebrated its 50th anniversary. It is a part of Newport News Shipbuilding that does largely work in the commercial nuclear space. We've done commercial nuclear construction back in the first big tranche of nuclear power plants being built in the country, did maintenance for a lot of years, and today we're back involved, as Mike said, with building nuclear components down at the two plants being built, or the four plants being built, two in South Carolina and two in Georgia. So very involved in that. We're also big in boiler water circ pumps, big in pressure vessel manufacturing. If it's specialty manufacturing, high degree of quality, that's where NNI is well suited to be competitor there. As we look at how do we expand, optimize this portfolio for both Navy programs, Navy and government services, and this nuclear energy services, there's huge opportunity out there, and I've got another slide that really talks about it. But in my mind, as I think about this and as we think about it, there are really different characteristics to each one, each piece of this. So as you look at the Navy programs, no surprise to you, very capital intensive, gives you long-term visibility, and the metrics that really kind of tell you how are you doing in that business is largely a return on sales metric. So that is Newport News Shipbuilding, you know, proper, if you would. On the Navy and Government Services business, again, you can, and we'll talk about the opportunities that are out there, but that market is really characterized by very low, if any, capital investment required. Requires very specialized skills, and then that the metric that talks about the value of that business, the how competitive, how good that business is really a return on investment metric. So kind of different, won't be the same kind of 9 to 10% business, but very different capital investment required there. On the nuclear energy services business, much like the Navy and Government Services, a whole bunch of opportunities forthcoming, low capital requirements, very competitive. Lots of people out in that space, so you have to have both be very competitive in your pricing, have the skills and capabilities, have that reach back into our organization. And again, as you think about it, that is a return on investment metric type business. So we talk about what are some of the pipeline opportunities out there. The Navy programs, it's very straightforward. It's CVN 80 construction. It is ultimately CVN 81. It's Block 5. It's the Ohio replacement construction effort. It's the continuation of the refueling overhaul, each one that we delivered coming in. It's LDUUV program as we look out into the future. On the Navy and government services side of the business, we are looking to how do we help the Navy introduce forward the aircraft carrier that has a completely different maintenance plan into the aircraft carrier maintenance planning process, and how do they get familiar with the ship and its construction, its design products, all those kind of things. There is private sector maintenance contracts that are, much like the IDIQ contract out in San Diego for carrier maintenance. There's, what opportunities present themselves on dismantlement of Enterprise, and, where do you continue to look at these regional maintenance centers and what contracts they have. One thing that's out there in the future is the SSN 762 engineered overhaul that's coming to Newport News. So certainly from the Navy and government services business, that's relatively clear. And on the energy side, whether it's the Savannah River extension, the Savannah River recompete, there's a Nevada National Security Site, there's a Hanford Waste Treatment Plant, commercial nuclear fabrication, and Idaho M&O. So lots of opportunities as you look out into the future for all these Navy and government services business, especially as you look at these Navy businesses, you're really looking to where you can provide additional higher value support, IT, C4, ISR, and a lot of different opportunities. So there is this great robust pipeline of opportunities. When we talk about Newport News and we talk about the shipbuilding business, we talk about the investments we're making. So we're really looking at where do you make the right investments to maintain capabilities, to go be and sustain your competitiveness, and how do we ultimately reduce costs. Largely, you do that by building large facilities, large infrastructure that brings work indoors. You're looking at machine tools and how do you improve the capabilities? How do you, get state-of-the-art welding technologies, design products out there? It's all those pieces. What I have is a quick little video. You see this. You see this specialized fixture. So one of the things we build repetitively on Virginia-class submarines is bows and sterns. Bows and sterns are very, very challenging to build from an accuracy control, from a, it is largely, a lot of welding and being able to maintain tolerances and all that. So what I want to do is show you, this is just kind of a video clip of a fixture that we are off today to go acquire. This is how do you go about manufacturing this. This is large, very large diameter, and what you have to do is go bring these plates together, weld them together, measure and manage the accuracy control of the thing. You're flipping it over. You're bringing in welding gantry cranes. It is a very deliberate process, and what I tell you is this machine really helps take a lot of footprint that you have today in the yard and consolidates it at this one location. So this is a company called APCO that is off to build this fixture today, and it allows us to repetitively build and improve the quality, take out man hours, ship over ship as we continue to go do this. And you can see where it's bringing in bulkheads, it's bringing in tanks, it's bringing in stiffeners, and this is an investment that's pretty significant, but drives out both, significant cost and improved schedule performance. This is a process that takes many, many months to go through over today in the manual process. And lastly, as we kind of look to position ourselves for the future, we want to be like many, but we want to be the provider of choice, offering best value to all both our DOE, our Navy customers, commercial customers alike, for across all those segments of the business. So we want to build on that strong foundation as we grow Newport News Shipbuilding. So with that, I'll open it up to a couple questions. Dwayne, is what you want to do? Okay.
Very good. If you have a question, please raise your hand and also state your name and the company that you're with before you pose your question. So. You just talk. Jason Gursky from Citi. You mentioned that the fixture reduces a lot of labor, but you didn't talk about exactly how much. Yeah, how much labor does it take to build that piece today? And
it's a significant amount of labor. This fixture will reduce that both time and schedule by about 50%. And it is this is a fixture that can be expandable, that allows us to build various dimensions of hull diameters as you look out into the future to make sure it remains flexible.
Okay, and when will that be?
We should have this fixture in the yard here in about the next, within the next 2 years. It'll be up and running, and we're able to build bow sections with that, bow and stern sections.
And lastly, can you talk a little bit more about the other capital investments that you'll be making at the yard over the next few years?
Yeah, so, what we've done, one of the big ones that has had a huge payback is we've completely recapitalized all the welding equipment in the yard. Welding equipment that is now internet connected. It is much more. The welder himself can set the parameters and maybe it's very technical, but as you're doing the welding itself, a lot of it is as the probe is away from the steel, it causes the voltage and the amperage to change. This thing is recognizing that, adjusting all those parameters, higher quality welds, higher weld deposition rate. So that's just an example of some of the machine tools we're putting in. But we're building large facilities, large cranes, capability to bring work indoors so it's out of the weather day to day. Some of the unique facilities on this bow and stern section, we put in a very large press with a series of progressive dies to be able to squeeze those pieces that we need that support feeding that fixture as we go and put that work together. So largely, as you bring work indoors, you get huge amounts of competitive advantage. It takes out cost. You're not impacted by weather. Very high payback projects.
I have the mic here. Sam Pearlstein from Wells Fargo. You mentioned a couple things about government services and the DOE work, that they're both return on invested capital type of businesses versus margin businesses. Mm-hmm. So I guess, can you just talk about how do you see the mix shifting over the next several years? Do you see the percentage of those businesses going up, and does that mean Newport News margins don't look like a 9 to 10% kind of margin business as we go out in years, or is it something that it's not changing that significantly in terms of the mix?
Well, I hope it changes significantly because it means we're successful at growing that part of the business. So I think what we're doing is, I think you kind of have to, bifurcate your thoughts. Newport News Shipbuilding will be in the 9 to 10%. This other business will be looking at good returns from an invested capital standpoint. The blended rate may see something less than 9% overall. But, it's really the two different businesses being measured against what is the right measuring stick for each one of those.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Byron Callen, Capital Alpha Partners. I know you really can't talk about the actual split on the Ohio replacement program, but can you give us a sense about the timing on when those decisions might be made? And also, if you think about your role, is there going to be a substantial capital expenditure to accommodate that program? Well, over the balance of the decade.
Yeah, and I largely we're not going to comment a whole lot on this thing. Certainly the Navy has publicly come out and said that they've asked both Electric Boat, Newport News Shipbuilding, to try to figure out what is the right work split to go do this. So we're off endeavor. We've endeavored to do that. The Navy timing, I think they'd like to have it resolved around an upcoming milestone event later this year. Not sure that's absolutely necessary. I would tell you that, you really at some point as the design process starts to mature, you really want to have figured out who's building what, because you should really be designing around this unknown set of manufacturing capabilities. So, you know, that's kind of where the Navy is, and we're just supporting the Navy and in those conversations about where this whole thing goes.
Yeah, hi, Carter Copeland with Barclays. Just sort of reading between the lines a little bit, just want to get a better sense of the growth rates. Obviously, you talked about the downtick in shipbuilding next year, but you know, presumably there's a modest recovery behind that. Sounds like you're planning for flattish volumes in shipbuilding over the 3 to 5 years you're talking about, but what sort of growth rates should we think are achievable in the other part of the business as you think over a multi-year basis?
Well, let me back up. You know, Newport News Shipbuilding, we have this period, and we talk about a valley that exists from now till 17. But in 2017, I actually am out hiring, and so we're starting to grow back up. This is just kind of the, you know, how the programs have matured and gotten us to this point where they've lined up. So in 17, I actually start hiring, and, you know, by the late 18s, I'm back up. To kind of almost where I am today, so it is truly a valley. From an ultimate growth standpoint, I think we have to see what the where the business takes it. You know, those are highly competitive areas. We have to be very competitive in our offerings as we're out there. But I think there are real opportunities as we go into the future with in that services business. So, kind of remains to be seen. But you know, we're really looking to make that a huge opportunity for us. Did I see somebody else?
Hi, Gautam Khanna of Cowan and Company. I was wondering if you could elaborate on the DOE services adjacency. Is this a market you're going to pursue organically, or do you see some acquisitions in that space? And just to clarify your response to Carter's question, are you expecting sales to be down through 17?
Certainly. Sales are certainly workforce size is going to be a part of a dictator of what the what sales look like. So, but again, in 17 we're actually hiring. So 16 is going to be a year of a bit of a downturn from a sales standpoint, but picks back up. Largely, as we go after the DOE side of the business, you know, we have a lot of reach back, a lot of capabilities in our own ability to go provide those DOE services. Stoller brings us an opportunity. So we'll have to go see what, you know, largely that business is characterized by teaming around developing the best team to go after some of those opportunities that present themselves because, you know, everybody brings certain skills and capabilities. So That's more how that business is done, but doesn't mean you don't look at that at all the you know all the range of opportunities to go manage that portfolio to the best extent.
Yeah, Ron Epstein, Bank of America Merrill Lynch. If you were to take a guess at this point on how the Ohio class is going to get funded, how would you guess?
You know, I certainly you got a coin. You know, I certainly think you see Congressman Forbes, you know, his perspective of trying to set up this strategic fund. I think the Senate is now very aligned around that. You know, it really is going to take people to put money in that strategic fund. It is the big question out there. How do you go fund that opportunity without impacting the rest of shipbuilding? It's got to be. In my mind, it's got to be money somehow coming into the overall budget. So something we have to see and figure out where it goes.
And then when we think about adjacencies, if something like you know Babcock and Wilcox, you know, you guys don't make reactors today. Is that a kind of adjacency you'd be interested in?
It is certainly an adjacency we know a lot about. We know those folks there, but you know I think you have to go figure out. You know, as you look at opportunities, what makes you the best owner of things, and you know, where do you, where does the sum of those two pieces give you a larger capability, larger offering? And, you know, we just have to go look out there and see who was all in available in that market space and go think about it.
Thank you.
Pete Skibitzky, Drexel Hamilton. Can you talk about the opportunity on the CVN 65 partial deactivation, just in terms of how likely is it to come your way, and maybe magnitude and timing?
You know, there'll be remain to be seen. There is a plan of record that has that ship taken to Puget Sound Naval Shipyard for dismantlement. That is, the Navy is asked to do a new environmental impact statement to look at some alternatives to that that could have to do with more commercial dismantlement to some extent. But Enterprise is unlike any other carrier, any other ship that's been dismantled, in that it is has a, you know, a nuclear propulsion plant, albeit defueled. It is still has some additional requirements and a unique set of skills have to be involved in that. So that they're looking at that. The ultimate disposal path for the propulsion plant is Hanford. So I think that that gets into the mix as well. So our involvement, you know, could be a pretty broad range there. You know, we're trying to work with the Navy to see what we can offer to the Navy to help them with the dismantlement of Enterprise, because whatever you do there may be, you know, as you look out into the future with Nimitz-class aircraft carriers may give you an opportunity there. So it's one of those things that we're all staying close to and seeing where the opportunity goes. Okay? Well, thank you very much.
Great. We're going to take a 15-minute break and reconvene. If you didn't get your question answered, if you have another question, feel free at the panel Q&A at the end to pose your question as well. So see you in about 15 minutes.
Okay, good morning. Hey, to get back started, I'm Brian Cusius, the president of Ingalls Shipbuilding. And, you know, a lot of people think of Ingalls Shipbuilding as a designer and builder of ships, non-nuclear ships for the Navy and for the Coast Guard, and that certainly is true. But we're unique in a couple other ways. So I'd like to show a video that I think our capability and capacity in the industry is really all by ourselves. So let me just run a quick video, and then I'll talk more about that.
Why Ingalls Shipbuilding? Because it's 800 acres of the most important real estate in America, the birthplace of some of our most complex military ships. With a 77-year legacy, Ingalls Shipbuilding has the talent, experience, and facilities to simultaneously build more classes of ships than any other shipyard in America. Destroyers, two classes of amphibious warships, and Coast Guard cutters. Today, a total of 9 ships are under construction, which is why our production line is the most efficient in the surface shipbuilding industry, supported by one of the most robust supplier bases in the country. Located in Pascagoula, Mississippi, Ingalls Shipbuilding is the largest employer in the state. It has the talent, the experience, and the facilities to build the capital ships that keep America and our allies safe. Ingalls Shipbuilding. Huntington Ingalls Industries. Hard stuff done right.
I'll applaud every time I see that video. 4 classes of ships. And these aren't small classes. These are significant programs. And I'll cover what those programs are in a minute. 9 ships under construction at the same time. We're doing very well on schedule, and our cost is improving across the board on every program. I believe that's unique in the industry, and we're quite proud of that. We're the sole provider of 2 amphibious ships, the America and the San Antonio, and also for the National Security Cutter for the Coast Guard. And as Mitch said, we're one of 2 builders for the Arleigh Burke-class destroyer. We are the largest employer in the state of Mississippi with over 11,000 employees. We're actually one of the largest employers in the state of Alabama. Our history isn't as long as Newport News, but we're quite proud of our 77-year history. So we have the legacy of experience and talent for all aspects of ship design, ship modernization, and ship construction. Our revenues in 2014 were $2.3 billion, with an operating income of $229 million, and a 10% operating margin. So if you look at our financial stream since 2012, our revenues have been well over $2 billion, but our margin has significantly increased through the third quarter of 15 at 11.4%. That's really due to improved operations and getting really good and focused on risk management and serial production. Current backlog, both funded and unfunded, is at $6.8 billion. Now, talk about some of the programs. Large deck amphibious ship. We've delivered 14 of these ships in the class. At 844 feet long and 45,000 tons, these are significant and really complex ships to build. And they come in really 2 versions. The picture on the left shows the large deck with a well deck, and most of the classes of ships have a well deck. That's where troops, cargo, vehicles can translate through ship and shore connectors or LTACs or hovercraft, and you see a picture on the bottom of that taking place. It can also move troops and similar things through the flight deck, and it has a significant flight deck. The version on the right has the well deck closed in, does not have a well deck. And it's more of an aviation-centric vessel. The LHA-6 America that we delivered in 14 and the Tripoli that we're building now are both aviation-centric versions, centric ships. The LHA-8, the next large deck, it will have a well deck designed back into the hull. Now, this one will be based on a competition between Ingalls and NASSCO. And it will be based on a combined competition between 6 TAOs, or auxiliary ships, or oilers, and 1 LHA-8. Can't win both, you can only win one. Next amphibious ship I'd like to talk about is a San Antonio class amphib. Now, it's not as large as the large deck, but at 26,000 tons, about, is still a significant platform. We have delivered 90 ships to date. We're getting very good in serial production on these ships. The cost performance and the schedule performance in LPD 26 and 27 for their class to themselves. We've really got this program figured out well, and we're really on a good trend. LPD 26 will deliver in 16, and 27 will deliver in 2017. Congress, as Mitch said earlier, has the funding appropriated for LPD 28, so we look forward to that war early next year. Now, there's something you may have heard, the Swiss Army knife. The LPD class has been called a Swiss Army knife because of its versatility. It can move troops, it can move vehicles, it can move cargo. From sea, it also has a well deck, like the large deck, but it can also move it off a flight deck. It has great command and control. It's also a survivable platform. So why is that important? Well, amphibs many times do humanitarian aid and go all across the world helping other countries and helping other areas. But a survival ship also can go where the Navy and the Marines need to go, can go safely, and can bring their troops home safely. So it's a very versatile ship. Performance is operating the fleet very well. So much so, the Navy has decided that the whole form of LPD will be used as a basis for the future LXRs. That's the future series of amphibs. There's 11 of those ships, and we're looking forward to bidding on that program and winning that program. Service combatants, the Arleigh Burke class destroyers. We have a long history in building Arleigh Burkes. We've delivered 28 of those ships. We have 7 ships under contract, and we have 4 under construction. The DDG-113 was the first ship after the program restart. So we had to reestablish our program management team, reestablish our production team, and I would say we're moving very well into serial production on the destroyer program. And you can see deliveries basically every year. National security cutters. Now, these are the largest, most sophisticated ships in the Coast Guard fleet. We've delivered 5 of these ships with the James, and we have 3 currently under construction. And they'll deliver over the next few years. This program is really hallmarked by stable requirements, a very good serial interval, and really fantastic learning. We talked earlier about the desire to have more national security cutters. And this program is well positioned to build more at a very affordable value. We're looking forward to building NSC-9 if that happens. We also have fleet maintenance services on 2 programs. We have offices across the country and also in Japan. So when I look at positioning for the future, you've heard a term that was used almost on every program, future competition. We've been building LHA since the 60s, and now we're competing for LHAA. So we are moving into even a stronger environment of competition. So positioning for competition is really all about improving your efficiency and getting your costs down. So when I look at that, that really starts with the basics. How well are you doing your fundamentals? Safety, quality, cost, and schedule. With clear ownership and accountability. And I'm very pleased where the shipyard is today with executing on the basics. It does require innovation and agility. And we have begun our path on being a more agile and innovative organization, bringing better ideas, new ideas, and to effectively incorporate those into the process. But then it also requires investment in people, in processes, and facilities. And when I look at investment, I look at how do you change the what is required to produce, the statement of work. How do you simplify the statement of work? And then how do you execute that in the most efficient manner possible? And so when you do that, you have to start at the very beginning of the process. So we're investing in the engineering process. How do you build a ship? What do your systems look like? What's the product flow through the yard? What information does production need? Every aspect of the front of the business. but it also requires the brick and mortar. So this is the current state of the shipyard as we have it. And this involves looking at, well, how does material flow through the yard? So we're investing for better product flow through the yard. We're also looking at better product flow within the facilities that we have. Increased automation, better cover, better lighting, better services, better access for the workers to execute their work. And we're also looking at how you increase the facilities and cover. Matt talked about the covers and the facilities. In Mississippi in September, it's quite hot, and it rains a lot. To get cover, to put our workers in an environment of no rain, better lighting, less heat, really increases our efficiency. So you have to look at every aspect of the product flow and enabling our workers to give them the best chance to be as productive as they can. That's what our investments are focused on. And certainly it requires leveraging for the future. The LP Hull platform has fantastic internal volume. It has great stability. So why is that important? I have an example you see, BMD, Ballistic Defense. The ship allows you to put a lot of weight up high. You don't have to wait for technology to be improved, to be lighter or less heavy. The ship can accept the weights as they have to technologies that exist today. Big radars require a lot of cooling and a lot of power generation. The ship's internal volume has plenty of space to handle all the power generation and all the cooling. This is just kind of one fence post on how versatile it can be for, say, ballistic defense. But it also has applications for a lot of other platforms. So I believe execute on the basics and do them well, and I'm very pleased on where we are with that. Invest in the people and the processes and the facilities, and I believe we're right on the mark in that area. And leveraging our current businesses positions us well for the future competition. And with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you. Daryl Genovese from UBS. So you have a couple of competitions or decisions coming up on both the LXR as well as the LHA-8 that you had mentioned. I guess in both cases, you kind of being positioned well, as the incumbent on the LPD and on the previous LHAs and LHDs. Was there a reason to think, other than an irrational bid from your competitor, that the Navy would, choose to go in another direction? I mean, can you just help us understand, kind of what you think might impede your ability to win those two programs? Thank you.
Well, so you can only win one of two, 6TAOs or LHA-8. I can't speak for the customer, but what I do know is we have to prepare to successfully bid and execute either program that the Navy decides to make the award. I don't know where the award will go. What I do know is I understand my risk. We understand our opportunities. We know how to bid both programs. My legacy, I've been in shipbuilding 36 years. I was at Avondale for many of those years, for 13 of those years. That's when we built the TAOs. So I have both commercial experience and large deck experience. So we actually know how to bid and execute both programs. So we look forward on either selection that's made, we look forward to executing those programs.
You wouldn't have a preference between the LHDA versus the TAOs?
I would say that we're ready to produce either program that's selected to us.
Thank you.
Yeah, Carter Copeland, Barclays. Wondered if you could give us some color on the investments you talked about in the yard, just in general terms, what size we should be thinking those are over a multi-year basis, and then any metrics you can share in terms of what that helps from a cost, productivity, flow, any kind of standpoint on what kind of goals you have for those investments.
Well, the view is about a five-year plan in terms of the capital improvements. Let's see if I can. So I'll give you. I'll talk to some specific investments that we're going to implement. The very bottom part of the chart is the dry dock. And so the dry dock that we currently have was built in the early 60s. It really has very little life or very expensive update and maintenance to have a very old dock after you do that. But when we think about the product flow through the yard, our draw dock approach at this time will allow, right now ships can only launch from one position in the yard. So that effectively could be a bottleneck. The new dry dock will have the ability to launch in various places of the yard in two different positions. So now I've expanded the product flow into the different product lines that we have. The another type of expansion is if you go see, the very first aerial that is going north to south, and the very that part of the building is our covered slab area. We're going to expand some of our covered slab area. So we have a very efficient covered area where we're doing big unit manufacturing and build out. But right now we don't have the space. We have to build some of that outside. And as I talked about, in all candor and seriousness, we had 5 inches of rain last week in Mississippi. All those guys went home. We paid them 2 hours because they showed up for work. So not only do I lose the efficiency of having to send them home, I have to now remove the water from the units. Now, this time of year isn't as bad as August. But in the heat of August, when it's mid-high 90s and 100% humidity, you know, and I want efficiency, I want, you know, a lot of hours of productivity, cover in the right environment. One, it's an encouragement to the workforce. It gets to the heart and mind of the shipbuilder, but it's also smart business. So those are just two examples of our capital investment.
Miles Walton, Deutsche Bank. And the first one was on CapEx and if there's a conditional CapEx plan you have as it relates to these competitions. How much of your CapEx is, you know, specific to an application versus not in your kind of 3 to 5 year plan and how you stage that? And then second, could you make a comment on growth of the business, volume of the business, as you see it over the coming years under a scenario where the most likely outcome you get LHA-8 and LXR?
Well, I won't go into the specifics on capital for bid projects, but the capital investments, that is considered in our bid strategies. I'll just say it to that level. And your other question was on?
I can follow up on that. So your CapEx strategy executes prior to the bid?
Well, it depends. So we take all, so our CapEx program, we look at all our current business, and we look at all our new business. And we look in the cut-in point of both, I'll call it firm business and new business, and we have then scheduled the CapEx project on when they time on different programs. So we know the benefit on when they come online, both on firm business that we have as well as new business coming forward.
Okay. And the other question was on the timing or the profile of your sales.
Well, 16, I think 16 will be similar to where we are. But, you know, 17 and out years, we've talked about acceleration of LXR, acceleration of LHA-8, potentially NSC-9. Those are all very important to the out years for us. And so that's a key focus, and our volumes will be based on how successful we are in pulling those programs ahead or not.
Sure. Byron Callen, Capital Alpha Partners. Brian, two questions. First, can you talk a little bit about workforce stability? Because I would imagine when oil prices were much higher, you may have had people being pulled out of the yard up to North Dakota, for example. I'm just curious if you can kind of quantify how stable your workforce has been over the last year or so and how that looks in 16 and 17. Then the other question is on the Icebreaker. That's potentially a very large ship, right, about $1 billion price. When could that come to play, and how do you see that acquisition strategy unfolding? Thanks.
Well, from the labor force question, I'm very pleased with our labor force stability right now. Our attrition is very low. Our apprenticeship school, and we have openings for the apprenticeship school, and it's usually 100 to 200. We'll have 5,000 applicants. So the region and the area knows it's a great place to work. It's fantastic training, and we support our employees. So I'm very comfortable with where we are, and I think we're a great place to work for. And so I think the community and the areas also recognize that. In terms of the Icebreaker, I think first it has to start with, I would say, desire and want. It's not funded yet. And so the president has expressed his desire for an Icebreaker. I think the Coast Guard would like to see Icebreakers. The Coast Guard now is going through some studies on do they modernize the fleet that they have? Do they start with a new design, or do they use an existing design I actually don't know where those studies stand, but it's being seriously looked into.
Excuse me, Brian. Roman Schweitzer from Guggenheim Securities. You spoke about the serial production of your four classes currently going on, but you're shifting to Flight 3 on DDG. You'll have some new design on LHA, new design on LPD-28, and then, of course, LXR. So is it fair to say that, or how would you characterize that in terms of changing from, you know, serial production to not necessarily a completely new ship, but is there some potential risk there as you transition to production on those, and how should we think about that?
Well, so the way I think about that, when we started, I really wanted to make a point that we are really unique in our capability and capacity. But that isn't only just what happens south, I'll call it south of the fence where the ships are built. It also applies to the engineering force. So we have 800 engineers. And we have done a significant amount of new ship designs and modernization designs. So I think one of our strengths actually is how to look at change work, how to properly address it, how to cut the timing into production and have the least amount of impact in the production flow. I think that actually is one of our strengths, not a risk. Now, it does, you know, it isn't as easy as not having a change like the NS6. But if you do it well, I think it can be a strength, and I believe ours is a strength.
Yeah, just maybe provoking that in yourself, but if I just did a rough calculation, you said about $200,000 in employee vehicles and 180,000 Newport News. So my question is the Newport News that much more labor intensive, or do you get the benefit by having a lot more self-storage business?
I'm not sure I understand your question. Could you?
If I just look at the sales per employee based on the number you just about $200,000 in global and $180,000 in Newport News. Just looking at the two businesses, and one Newport News that much more labor intensive, or you just benefiting by the fact that you got self-sourced business carriers and Angle doesn't have to self-sourced.
Oh, Bob may be the best one to maybe address from both. You know, I can speak from Ingalls and what our business is. And that certainly in nuclear is, you know, that's not conventional shipbuilding. It's nuclear shipbuilding, and they inherently come in with their own value stream and own value sets. So I don't know how to actually answer that question, you know, just from here.
Yeah, I would say we've been asked that question. We don't really look at sales per employee because what you have is significant material moves around. And when you think of the cost of a ship, and this is just roughly speaking, it's a third material, a third direct labor, and a third overhead. And so how that material flows through and the timing of it makes a real difference when you calculate that. But I think there's a benefit of serial production. You're seeing it at Ingalls. And I think that when you look at the Newport News business, you have a lot of planning associated with the next RCOH in there, so a lot of engineering work going on that Ingalls does not get planning contracts for their next ships. So there's a different business. So it's beyond just the carrier. It's just the difference in the business.
Okay, I would like to introduce Philip Luna, president of UPI.
Good morning. My name is Philip Luna. As Brian said, I'm responsible for the UPI organization. I want to start with a little bit of my background. My 35 years in the industry has been all oil and gas capital projects. First half of my career was on the owner-operator side, worked for ExxonMobil and then Enterprise Products. Second half of the year has been on the services side of the business, primarily with Jacobs and Fluor before joining UPI. Joined UPI 3 years ago in my current role. So let me start with also a little video. Mine's a little different in that this is the video we put together to show down in our lobby in Houston. In that lobby, we have three screens. One is actually the metro traffic map, because in a city like Houston, that's important to our employees. The other is a safety message, and then this message about our employees and who we are.
Universal.
Universal Pegasus International delivers world-class expertise, unparalleled customer satisfaction, efficiency and value in project management, engineering, and construction management for the energy industry. Building on our legacy of excellence in onshore and offshore pipelines and facilities, we are positioned to use our talent, experience, and technical expertise to expand our market position in the oil and gas industry.
We have the talent. We have the experience.
We have the technical expertise.
We will fulfill our vision of driving business success through execution excellence by creating value for strategic and trusted partners in adjacent services and geography. And we'll do it all while maintaining our commitment to health, safety, and the environment. Universal Pegasus International delivers talent, experience, and technical expertise.
We are UPI.
Huntington Ingalls Industries. Hard stuff done right.
Well, not quite as exciting as shipbuilding, but we think equally important to the nation's energy and the infrastructure that we help build. So basically, a little bit about the company. UPI is really similar to other parts of Huntington Ingalls in terms of AMSEC, SN3. We're a service provider. We're a service provider that also has low capital requirements and specific expertise. So we have an expertise in the oil and gas midstream market. Currently, we have between 700 and 800 people, and that does fluctuate routinely with specific projects and the market. Our offices in UK and Trinidad are small offices. They give us the ability to deliver projects internationally, particularly Trinidad in Latin America, and the office in Aberdeen is North Sea, Africa, Asia, and the Mediterranean. The majority of our staff actually sit in the U.S. in Calgary. Those are our two major engineering centers. When you look at the revenue, roughly 25 customers produce 70% of our revenue. Okay, so those 25 are the big guys. And then the remaining part of our revenue, 30%, it takes over 50 customers to produce that. So we have a large customer base, do a lot of projects in order to generate the revenue on an annual basis. We've been in business just over 50 years as Universal INSCO originally, and then into Universal Pegasus as the slides and video talked about. When you look at our financials, from 2012 to 14, we were growing roughly 10% a year in a much more buoyant market, right? At the end of last year, the oil changed price and started to decline. So at the end of last year, we started to see an impact to our revenues. And this year, as you can see, is the largest impact to our revenues. Our backlog fluctuates and is a pretty good indicator of future, we think. And as you can see, the second half of this year, our backlog has started to improve. So we're optimistic about the future. Right now, that's primarily taking market share from others. Don't see a big change in the actual market. We operate today in the midstream market. When you talk about oil and gas, you can divide it into three markets: upstream, exploration production; downstream, chemicals and refining. And what we hit is that midstream transportation business, okay? Today, that globally is about a $100 billion business. However, when you take that down to the addressable market for us, it's about a $10 billion business globally. And that's the engineering services that we provide. engineering, procurement services, construction management. We don't play in all parts of the globe. We don't play in lump sum risk projects. We don't play with certain customers where, you know, it's difficult to get paid and other reasons. So when you really boil it down to the market that's available to UPI, we see that as about $1 billion a year market in the midstream sector. And those projects are all projects that we bid on every day against competition. We have very, very little sole source work in that market. Today, because of the oil prices, the majority of our work is onshore. About 80% is in the gas business. The liquids business and the offshore business have been hit the hardest by the oil pricing, so those markets have contracted quite a bit. The onshore work that we're doing is primarily in the lower 48 and in Mexico. And as I said, that's primarily gas work today. As you can see by the customers that we serve, stable, long-term customers, they've just all trimmed their capital spend for the current time. This is just a map showing some of the current projects that we're working on. We're actually working in all the major midstream markets in the U.S. today. We're licensed in most of the lower 48 states to deliver projects with our licensed surveyors and engineers. This last year, we actually received the Oil and Gas of Engineer of the Year Award in both the U.S. and in Canada. The two primary markets that we serve recognize our capabilities and expertise, so we're very proud of that. Even in a down market, that's very important to our business and to our customer base. History of the company, we've designed over 5,000 projects. When you look at the midstream market, that equals over 40,000 miles of pipe, over 5 million horsepower of both compression and pump stations. So that's a lot of projects, a lot of compressor stations, pump stations, and miles of pipe that we've worked on in the domestic U.S. Recently, as part of HII, we've had the opportunity to collaborate on a number of projects. People ask us, you know, regularly, how do we fit into HII? And yeah, my answer is always very, very well. This is an indication of some of the things that we've been able to do. UPI had a customer here on the Gulf Coast. Well, they're on the Gulf Coast. I'm used to being in Houston. Down south on the Gulf Coast that needed some heavy lift expertise for an offshore platform. We had the expertise but didn't have the resources available at the time. We were able to reach out to Brian and get some help from Ingalls just there in Mobile. So they provided a resource to our client. Would work for about 2 months that they were able to do that, helped us maintain the client relationship, gave us the ability to do the work and continue on with that client. So that's one example of resources that we were able to reach back and get help from. Also had an opportunity for an East Coast pipeline compressor station project. That particular project was going through Virginia. And one of the key factors for the selection in that project was local knowledge, local expertise. We were able to get help from both corporate and Newport News for the local content and local expertise. We ended up being selected for that project as a result. So that helped us in the bid process and selection process. And then very recently had a pipeline in the Midwest that we were bidding on. Typically, in our type of work, clients often ask for either bonding or a letter of credit, basically a guarantee that we're going to be around to do the work. And in this case, we were able to offer a parent company guarantee. That basically lowered our bid price. We were able to be selected for the work on a competitive basis, primarily because of the balance sheet that was behind us and our ability to offer that parent company guarantee was a key factor in our selection. So we currently work with Huntington Ingalls on a number of things. Other parts of the business have helped us, and it's been very beneficial as part of the company. It's also given us the opportunity to go from universalpegasus.com to HIIUPI.com. 16 letters to 6 letters makes a big difference. So all important. Internationally, we provide projects, as I said, out of our Aberdeen, Scotland office, Calgary, and our office in Trinidad. Aberdeen is primarily offshore projects. We provide project services in, like I said, offshore Africa, offshore India, the Mediterranean, several places that Aberdeen gives us a window into those offshore opportunities. Calgary is primarily onshore pipeline business, just like the business in the U.S. Calgary has been impacted more because of the oil sands, so that market has retreated quite a bit. Not as many gas opportunities in the Canadian market. And Trinidad, as I said, is primarily offshore Latin America. We have a number of projects there that we're supporting. On the offshore side of the business, we've done more what I call midwater, you know, basically a mile depth, midwater tiebacks than anybody in the industry. We've done over 100 tiebacks in that type water. We've also done over 125 at least, you know, individual type subsea structures. Each subsea structure is a specialized delivery. So, you know, 125 of those is quite a bit in the offshore market. We look at opportunities in like a global basis, and this is recent data from IHS in terms of both the onshore and offshore markets that we serve. Onshore, we limited to just pipelines and processing facilities, the type of work we do. And you can see through 2020, that's estimated to be a market in excess of the $60 billion a year range. That contributes to the $100 billion that I talked about earlier. And that's a market that we think on the pipeline business particularly is going to be sustainable. As you can see, processing and storage kind of starts declining after a couple of years. On the offshore side of the business, today we are primarily focused on the subsea portion of that, not the topsides and facilities quite as much. So the green highlights the engineering and the SURF, which is the subsea part of the business. Those two combined are going to be in excess of $50 billion a year market, also for the next 4 or 5 years. We do see, as you're well aware, that the market has contracted some this year, but believe that's going to be sustainable, and that's what IHS has said. So the long-term capital spend is going to continue to be in the $100 billion range a year for the oil and gas markets that we serve in the midstream. So what are we doing today in the market? We're actually trying very, very hard to size our business for the market as we see it today, okay? And that includes reductions in headcount, both billable staff and overhead or SG&A staff. We're down about 40% from previous highs. We've had to look at our organizational structure and restructured our senior management team to be in size with in line with the size of business we have today. So we've had some reductions there. And obviously had to do some things on the cost side of our business in terms of benefits and other things. In doing that, we've been sure to maintain our core capabilities. As Mike said earlier, when he talked about oil and gas, maintaining our capabilities for the future and being sure that we can deliver projects for our customers is very important to long-term viability. So we're making sure to do that. And we're spending a lot of time with our customers today, so that those relationships stay strong. We don't know when the market's going to turn. They don't know when the market's going to turn. But when it does, we want to be the ones that they come back to and that they select to do their project. So spending time with those customers is key. Like the rest of the Huntington Ingalls business, you know, our business is based on the same core values, right? Ethics, quality, safety drive our business. It's what drives our relationships with our customers. So that's very important that we maintain those things. So for the future, short term, you know, it's all about delivering project excellence in our execution, being competitive in the marketplace, delivering for our customers. That's what's going to be key for the short term, and that really means taking market share. That's our opportunity to grow the business. Longer term, we do see opportunities as the market rebounds, being in the right position, and growing back into larger projects as they come available. So in summary, we're still very optimistic about the oil and gas. As I said, I've been in the business 35 years, been through a couple of cycles, and still think this is a great business to be in. And more importantly, very excited about the opportunity to be in the business as part of Huntington Ingalls. It does give us a number of key capabilities and strengths that we didn't have before. So looking forward to that. So with that, I think any questions?
Ron Epstein, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. I guess this is more of a question for Mike. Said respectfully, what does this business have to do at all with shipbuilding?
Okay, so from our standpoint, as we looked at this business a couple of years ago, we were looking at our services, particularly our engineering services and engineering capabilities, and the customers that could tap into that place that we're not tapping into it today. And we see a great alignment between the things that the shipbuilding engineers are doing day in and day out and what this marketplace needs day in and day out. And let's just go, for instance, to the offshore business. You know, we believe that the Pentagon's going to go forward with, trying to be better at stuff that's undersea, whether it's undersea robotics, undersea unmanned, those kinds of things. You know, that's been going on in Philip and his guys have been doing that for a long time. And the reality is that a whole lot more money on the R&D side has been spent over on the commercial side of that than has been spent in the Pentagon side of that. And so if you try to go into that space and keep your blinders on to just tending to your knitting the way that you always have done, you will miss all of that innovation, all of that opportunity to marry up those kinds of things. We believe, and Philip mentioned, that once we find a way to create the channels for the great set of customers that UPI has to some of the great capabilities that were resident in shipbuilding, we believe that would we would be able to find a way to make that work better. And we had started down that path. Philip mentioned one example where one of his customers had reached into the shipyards to find some capability that was not resident anywhere else. You know, that's all been tempered right now because of the macro effect of the oil, the price of oil. But we still believe all of that is true going forward. And so the things that drive success in the services business in our government business are the same things that drive success in that marketplace. And we believe that there's a turn at some point in the future. We don't know when it is, and we believe that creating those channels for those customers is going to create new value for the company.
I mean, how much of your workforce in the shipyards is actually doing work for UPI?
Very little right now, and that's really, I think, we would love to have it be more, but there needs to be more projects there, right? I mean, I think the macro effect of the price of oil is driving a lot of, it's kind of crowding out all of the other discussion about synergy and capability and bench strength and all those kinds of things. So,
thank you.
Yep.
Right here. Going back to the slide where you're talking about addressable markets, you suggested that the addressable market is $1 billion for you today. Can you talk a little bit about what that addressable market looked like at the peak so we can get a sense of your market share? You had $230-some-odd million of revenue.
At the peak, the addressable market share for us was probably double in that range.
Okay. And then you mentioned a little bit about some of the benefits that you're getting from Huntington as it relates to the competitive environment, the balance sheet. It seemed like it was something that was important to you in a recent bake-off. Can you talk a little bit about the other things outside of the balance sheet that you think are going to be key to garnering market share? Because you said that's the way you're going to grow is through market share.
Yep. So market share opportunities for us really are, because all of our projects are competitive bidding, it means managing our cost side and being competitive in the market. And those are the things that I talked about earlier in terms of reducing our overhead, reducing some of the benefits plans, which are true costs for our business. So just managing that and, you know, chasing the right opportunities.
Lastly, what level of revenue do you need to see to be at break-even and, or better yet, at the same margin levels that the rest of the company is operating at?
That fluctuates. There's no set revenue level because it's dependent on our cost structure. It's dependent on margin per project. It's dependent on timing of projects. You know, we're working real hard to get there as quickly as we can, and believe that, you know, we need to stay focused on that. But there's not a specific target.
Sam Pearlstein, you mentioned in your backlog growth this year is mostly market share wins. Can you talk about why you're winning and why we're seeing that share shift?
A number of reasons. First is our cost structure. As I mentioned several times, we are continuing to reduce our cost structure to be more competitive, and some of the larger firms don't have that flexibility. Second is expertise. The last 3 years, as I showed, our revenue was growing, our market share was improving, our capabilities have improved, and that has helped also.
And secondly, you talked about offshore as a big opportunity, where you do mostly work midstream and onshore. How do you move offshore? What does it take to actually get there?
Offshore is still the same midstream market that we serve, both onshore and offshore. The piece of the market we serve is transportation, storage, terminals, those types of things. So our offshore business is the same. The reason it's an opportunity for us is because that we don't currently serve a lot of regions in the globe in the offshore part of the business. And in the offshore part of the business, there's a facilities part that we don't currently serve, you know, in a very large way, which is a future opportunity.
Byron Callen, Capital Alpha Partners. Phil, did the President's Keystone decision have any bearing on the way you think about opportunities over the next couple of years, positive or minus? And then for Mike, I can't see it because you're behind the podium, Mike, but, you know, with oil prices depressed, I don't know where valuations are for these kind of properties, but if you have high conviction in this part of the strategy for the company, isn't this a time to really continue to pursue it with additional acquisitions?
Keystone, Universal Pegasus was the engineer and field services provider of the first three phases of the Keystone project. As you can see by our customer pie, TransCanada has been our largest customer for the last 3 years. So the Keystone decision does impact our backlog and long-term project portfolio opportunities. It doesn't change the short-term, really. I don't think anybody on our side or TransCanada's side believed that Keystone was going to be approved quickly. So it's still a future opportunity. TransCanada says, if you listen to Russ Girling's comments, he believes it will come back, and when it does, it will still be a project that we'll have the opportunity to work on.
And, Byron, relative to the second question, you know, I get that a lot, really, is that, you know, well, heck, now's the time to really go in that space. You know, everything, I hope that you've seen already that everything that we do in our business starts from a place of execution, and we have to be able to execute. You know, we're not a company that's going to take a flyer on something and in the hope that it's going to work out for us. And so where we are today in that business, I have conviction about the marriage of our capabilities and that market. I don't have conviction about the size of that market or the growth rates in that market. And so what we're doing today is we're focusing hard on the execution piece. And my view is that we get the execution right at this level, then we'll be poised to support that space
And we have the horizon, you know, the core of our business has a long enough horizon for us to be ready for the turn in the market whenever it is. We don't need the, you know, we'd love to have the market turn tomorrow. But we don't need the market to turn tomorrow to satisfy our thesis for what we're trying to do. We'll be ready for it when it does. And we can, as long as we stay focused on the execution. And Philip and his team, I mean, they've really done a remarkable job. If in terms of what the decisions they've had to come through in the last 18 months to drive the execution of that business to where it is today, while maintaining the relationships they have with all of those customers. And quite frankly, they're teaching our core business an awful lot about how do you do this? How do you do this from a standpoint of cost management? How do you do this from a standpoint of customer relationships? And so if the value of your company, if the market value of your company is somehow a reflection of everything you know and everything that you do, we know a lot more, and we're doing a lot more today than we were 4 years ago.
Thank you.
Well, thank you all for this morning. I'm going to wrap up here with a bit of a summary and some probably, I hope, will be some specifics that you'll be able to walk away from here and say you got something out of the discussion this morning. First of all, I really want you to recognize that this is a company about substance, not style. You know, we start with how are we going to do today's work better than we did it yesterday? And we do that everywhere we go. It's all about execution. You've had a chance today to meet not only the leaders of our business units, but you've also met Mitch, who is part and parcel to what we do in terms of how we engage with the government on the vast majority of the work that we do. And so I hope that you walk out of here with a view that this company is all about substance. Not a whole lot of glamour here, not a whole lot of sizzle. This is about steak. The second thing is, as you have heard this, I think you've probably gotten a sense. I hope you've gotten a sense that at Newport News we've had a pretty steady run. Things could be pretty steady for the future, but we need to reinvest in that business because we have an opportunity, actually, at Newport News to continue to take advantage of our work in inactivations and in the Ohio Replacement Program, which are a little bit different than where we might have been over the last 10 years. But the issue at Newport News is how do you keep all of your programs affordable so that they stay in the budget? And so you can have to continue to make these kinds of investments in that business. What we're doing there are generational investments. You know, we're making investments that will change the cost profile of the Ford class to make it more affordable and more likely, if you will, going forward. At Ingalls, the issue is really about executing today. We've had a great run of improving the execution there over the last 4 years, but now it's building off of that execution, moving into an environment where there's going to be more and more competition. You know, Brian's talked about competitions on programs that have been sole source for a while. You know, you cannot go to sleep on the switch and win those programs. This is going to be something that we've got to bring our A game to make sure that we win. And so the investments that we're making in Ingalls particularly are really about how do you go and set yourself up to be competitive on a path going forward. And as we just talked about at UPI, again, it's all about the execution and making sure, you know, before we go much further with the oil and gas space, let's make sure we got this right and that we're executing well at these levels. That's going to put us in position for the future of that space, whatever it holds. So I hope that you've gotten that out of the discussion so far. Going forward, as we said at the beginning this morning, you know, we talked today. We completely delivered. We told you where we were going to be, and we are here. We did what we said we were going to go do. I think you got a sense that shipbuilding is the strong franchise of this business, and that, as I said earlier, it's hard to imagine a future where the Navy is not our principal customer and partner, and it's kind of hard to imagine a future for the Navy where we're not their principal supporter going forward. And I hope you've had a chance to interact with the management team and gotten a sense of this team that really did this work to get us to this place. But let's talk about now what to expect going forward. First of all, probably not a surprise, we've been talking about this already. We're going to continue to invest in our core business. We're going to continue to invest the capital that you need to invest in that. We're going to continue to develop the workforce to make that business as efficient, as effective as possible. That will be that partnership is the franchise of this business, and it is our number one priority. Our second priority is that over the next 5 years, we expect to return substantially all of our free cash flow to our shareholders. We believe that, as Barb has said earlier, we started to bring the shareholders along a little bit earlier than we thought because we were retiring risk a little bit faster than we expected when we came out in 2011. But we recognize that we're now at a point where we're no longer having to manage the cash for the risk register. And so we're at a place now where it's time to bring the shareholders along and bring them to where we are in this business. We've already begun that with a dividend increase and the board's announcement on dividend increase and the recent announcement of the share buyback. But I think that if you look at where we're going to be through 2020, I think that it's fair to say that over that time, substantially all of the free cash flow that we generate will be returned to our shareholders. And that still leaves us the capacity to optimize and expand our services portfolio in support of our customers now. A lot more customers today than we had 4 years ago, but we have the ability to engage with those customers and support them in a way that will be able to create new value for our business. Talking a little bit about the capital, we believe that if you look at our plans over the next 5 years, we're talking about a recapitalization of our shipyards to the tune of about $1.5 billion. While we'll be doing that, our shipbuilding business will be maintaining their margin targets. But frankly, the shipbuilding business is kind of flat through this business in total. You've heard this morning about puts and takes. Some programs are moving around. But in some ways, shipbuilding accounts are kind of like a balloon. If you push on it in one space, if it goes in one space, it goes out in another. And we are positioned so that when that happens, it keeps our business relatively flat. We always focus on safety, quality, cost, and schedule. And this allows us to keep our business focused on where our customer is going, flexible enough to respond to the newest customer needs, and gives us a chance to optimize that core business. And you get a sense, you've had a sense today of how deep that relationship is that we have in support of the program. I've said we're going to return substantially all of our free cash flow to our shareholders. Not only did we increase the dividend this year, we're committed to continuing to do that. We expect that between now and 2020, we would expect that our annual dividend increase would be on the order of about 10% at a minimum level. We started a share repurchase program a few years ago to offset dilution. But what's happened is, we're now at a place where just recently the board doubled that authorization. I think that authorization runs to 2019, right? So you're not going to make, the free cash flow and the share repurchase are not, that's not all going to quite line up exactly the way you want, but that just has to do with what the authorizations are. But we think that the shareholders have been very supportive of the path that we have been on. It's incumbent upon us to make sure that we bring them along with us as well. And finally, you've heard probably more about the services business today than you may have heard from us in the past. We think that there's real opportunity here. It's kind of hard to scale. There were a couple of questions about how do you figure growth rates and how do you size this and all that. It's really a challenge for us to find a way to characterize that because, first of all, it's dependent upon, for some of these DOE projects, it's dependent upon when the project actually gets bid and awarded. Secondly, it has to do with what's the teaming arrangement look like. If we find ourselves in a place where we're on another team, that's not really revenue for us. That's just equity income for us. And so trying to find the right way to size that and characterize that is a little bit challenging. On the other hand, it does give us the opportunity to create new cash, you know, and new cash for the business. And so we think there's great opportunity there. We think that, you know, we're going to continue to pursue that in a very very disciplined, logical, and aggressive fashion. There have been a lot of questions in the hallway and over the past day or so about what's our framework, how do we think about M&A? And let me just tell you that you know, we've done three acquisitions in since we came out. All of them have been great learning experiences for my team. But let's talk about the discipline that we want to make sure that you understand that we bring into our process. What goes first? Before we actually start rolling up our sleeves to try to figure out whether we want to pursue an opportunity or not, we actually have a discussion about why are we the better owner of that business than anybody else. And if we can't get through that conversation, we don't spend a lot of time on it from after that. If we get through that conversation, then we go and we say, okay, can we meet our financial requirements if we do this? And our financial requirements, clearly our returns in this business are going to exceed the cost of our capital, but we expect the business acquisition, we expect that acquisition to be accretive in our second full fiscal year, and we expect it to be cash flow positive in the second full fiscal year. And so even if we can decide that we're the very best owner of the business, and even if we've got a great strategic rationale for that business, if we can't meet those requirements, I don't expect that we'll be doing that acquisition. And one of the challenges that we see right now, Byron, back to your question, is when you go and start trying to figure out what would you do in the oil and gas space, well, okay, what growth rate do you want to project in there? Because that drives the valuation. You know, how do you value it? And so we can't get through this right now. So that's part of it, but it fundamentally starts with being able to execute. And then think about strategic rationale as we kind of think about it in terms of, you know, there's probably a heat map, right? And the closer you are to the center, the hotter you are, the closer you are to what we do, our basic core capabilities, the hotter it is, the more likely you can manage the risk of that possibility or that opportunity. The further away it is from that, the less risk appetite that we're probably going to have for something like that. You know, and I would acknowledge that whereas the Stoller and Undersea Solutions Group were probably pretty close to the center of what we do, UPI was a little bit further away from the center. And so we decided to go in that with a modern approach. And you know, it's turned out, and we're still optimistic about where it's going. But that's kind of the way we think about it. The closer it is to our capabilities and what we do, the more willing we are to understand the risk of what's happening there. So finally, this is our value proposition. We have a core business that is Navy shipbuilding and Coast Guard shipbuilding, and it is a stable business. It's a predictable business. It's a business that we can invest against. And it can be it is the anchor that drives this business. And as Matt alluded to before, what really is about value there in that business is how efficient are you at executing that work. And so we see that as an ROS business. The services businesses, on the other hand, are really an ROI business, and we've talked a little bit about that. They're very low in terms of the capital requirement, a lot more human capital engagement. Both of those come together, though, and give us the opportunity for really strong cash flow generation. And then the question is, what do you do with the cash? And we've kind of laid that out. The first thing we're going to do with our cash is we're going to invest in our core business. The second thing we're going to do with our cash is we're going to bring our shareholders along. The third thing that will happen is that we're going to continue to try to create new value in this business and try to find ways to improve the overall capabilities of the business. And so it's a long horizon business, but we believe that our approach here for a long horizon business is a sustainable approach, a sustainable way for long-term value creation. And with that, now we stand ready to answer, we'll try to answer any of your questions. Right here.
Maybe just two quick ones here. Ron Epstein, Bank of America. How do you find your M&A targets when you in that framework you just talked about? Is it bankers? Do you have your own team? Where do they come from?
You know, the aperture is pretty wide open. The first place and the preferred place that I like to think about in terms of the best ones I'm most interested in are when these guys walk into the room and say, you know, we've been doing a lot of work with those guys, or we think they're really good and they're in our space and we are complementary. That's the best place to find the opportunity. Certainly, we have all of the other usual suspects line up with all kinds of great ideas to throw at us. But from my standpoint, the best way to understand what's going on in the business is from the people that are in those businesses.
Okay. And then of the $1.5 billion that you want to invest in the core business, how much of that will ultimately be reimbursed through your contracting structure?
So through depreciation, it all gets reimbursed. So it's included in our rates and our forward pricing. So, but in addition to that, we always look for other people's money first. And one of the things, Brian, I can't remember if it was on the slide or not, but we have a partnership with the state of Mississippi who's also investing in the Ingalls Shipyard. And Matt's always looking at the opportunity, other people's money. So we look across the board. But from our particular investment, it's recovered in our rates and we put it in our forward pricing.
Yeah, it really is pure cap. I mean, it's a capital number. It doesn't talk to the whole level of investment that's going to be made in these facilities to bring them forward. You know, Matt just had the state of Virginia just invested in an apprentice school at Newport News, Mississippi. The relationship between us and our states, we're the largest employer in the states of Virginia and Mississippi. So the relationship between us and the state government is really strong, and what's good for the state is good for us and good for them.
Yeah, just Carter Copeland, Barclays. Barb, I want to bring up your favorite topic ever, which is pension. Since we all love it so much. I wondered, in the free cash flow you're talking about, obviously pension and with the uptick in CAS is an important part of competitiveness and cost and what you're talking about. What do you envision in terms of pension contributions over the course of this, you know, five-year plan? And maybe just give us an update on, you know, CAS reimbursement over that period, if you can.
So one of the things we always have to be very thoughtful of is because we are a long-term contractor and we're putting together proposals that last over many, many years, we did not opt for the MAP 21, so the artificial discount rates. We actually use market-based discount rates. And I think that, you know, we always have to look at the timing of things for us. And one of the reasons why we chose to do that was because of the timing of the contracting to make sure we were going to get recoverability using the current market rates. And you were taking a bet on whether the discount rate was going to go up or not, and kind of got lucky it didn't go up the way people wanted it to go. In terms of looking at the future and everything, the biggest thing we have that affects pension contributions is in 2017, and it's related to the changes in the Society of Actuary Mortality Tables. And we are working our way through that because you can opt to use your actual experience. And our initial cut at looking at that our actual experience is that we would have 20% less contributions than required using the Society of Actuary Tables. But you have to get your ducks in line to be able to do that and have an audited process related to that. So because those tables really, you know, life expectancy is much longer, does create a pop in contributions in 2017. We also like to maintain our pension funding at a 90% on a PPA basis, so I have to take that into consideration. And then, you know, beyond that, it's really what do your return on assets do each year? What are discount rates do each year? So I really don't want to give you an exact number. We've kind of planned in our plan for, we use the Society of Actuary Tables. So in our internal planning, we kind of try to look at the worst-case scenario, and then we're trying to come down from there where we'll be. And we'll keep you informed at the call at the end of the year. We'll give you an update of where we'll be for 2016. And if we have more information on 2017, I'll be happy to give it to you then. Okay?
Daryl Genovese from UBS. So you have committed to returning substantially all of your free cash flow to shareholders over the next 5 years, but at the same time you haven't ruled out the potential for future M&A. So just wondering, within that context, if you could talk about your leverage a little bit, how much debt are you willing to take on, and then also, what do you think is the optimum leverage level for the business? Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll start and I'll let Barb talk to that. I my sense of it, we've improved the balance sheet pretty substantially since we spun this out. Pretty comfortable now that we've refinanced our bonds, pretty comfortable with how that went down and where that is. In some ways it depends on the opportunity. If we have the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, you kind of think your way through that. It becomes part of the calculation in terms of whether it makes sense for us financially to go forward or not and how we would do that. I'm comfortable with the way that our refinancing went this year. I like where we are from a health standpoint, and I believe that where we are gives us the flexibility to go do the things that we think we will need to do in the next 5 years. And as to where precisely the optimum level is, I don't know, Barb, if you have any sort of comment on that or not.
Yeah, I think it was important to us to get, better rates and investment grade type covenants in our bond refinancing and with our bank refinancing. I think we're comfortable where we are. We like the flexibility where we are, and we just have to wait and see what the opportunities are.
Just a clarification, is the commitment starting with the clock in 2016 or is it 2015?
Yeah, don't look backwards.
Fourth quarter, we're going to get 100% of the free cash flow.
Yeah, I mean, we're at the...
Just want to mark it down.
That's right, yeah. We're going to do one big Hume correct here in the fourth quarter. No, scratch that. We are not going to do that. I just got kicked under the table. We won't be doing that. They just started. They're gonna haul me out of here real quick. But no, it's really 2016 going forward. You think about the business and how we're executing and operating the business. We built the balance sheet to where we like where we are on the balance sheet. Now it's time for us to go run the business and create value and return value to our shareholders.
One other question: is the recovery from Avondale baked into the assumption?
Yes, it is.
Yes. Okay, yep. Thanks.
That was part of my question was the whole the old chart where working capital became a source of cash. Maybe you could speak to that in terms of timing of reimbursement. If you're confident we'll get an agreement with the Navy this year in 2016, and the impact from the pension pop you mentioned in 2017, is it still looking like a nice smooth curve up, or are there a few more?
I think it does. There could be some bumps in the road. It's all timings and ship deliveries too have a big impact. So. But we are actually on that path of recovering. We've done very well on working capital and managing working capital over the last few years, and we'll continue to do that. So Avondale will play, restructuring will play into it, and the timing of that a little bit. But that's not the biggest pop there. That was a small pop compared to the ship deliveries. So.
Right.
Byron Callen, Capital Alpha Partners. Mike, we've got a new CNO, a relatively new CNO, Admiral Richardson, compared to Admiral Greener. Any thoughts on nuances, changes, directions, things that he would like to accomplish? That's one question. And the other question, when you think about the Navy services opportunity, is this more kind of competing against BAE Systems, GD, some of the other public companies that are also engaged in Navy, or are you really looking at taking share or working with the public yards? Norfolk, et cetera.
Yeah, so first of all, it's a privilege for me to have known
John Greenert really well, and to know Admiral Richardson really well, and I would say that what the Navy does really well is that they do keep a pretty consistent path, and so you know, I think it's a great question to ask Admiral Richardson, you know, how he sees it. My view of it is that there is certainty and stability in the handoff between CNO Greenert and CNO Richardson, and we find that to be very comforting, and it allows us to be confident when we go and make these investments for, I mean, we're not talking about a quarter investment, we're talking about a generational investment in our shipbuilding capability, and stability in that part of the Navy gives us a lot of confidence to go and do that. And the second question was?
Services.
Right. So, you know, Navy services kind of run the gamut, and you've kind of talked about it there. You know, there's some of the services businesses that are a little bit heavier on assets. You know, we have Continental Maritime, for instance, as a repair activity in the Navy maintenance part of the world. Some of the people that you've mentioned are really robust in terms of their facilities to go and do that kind of maintenance. You know, our view of it has been that there's real value in keeping your assets as light as possible. It keeps you agile. It actually keeps you more connected because you can be where the fleet is as opposed to having them be where you are. And so when you see the map there of where we are in support of the customers, we're not really talking about shipyards. Except for Continental, we're really talking about teams, whether they are in doing alteration planning or in maintenance support or flying away some of our shipbuilders to go and do a specific thing on a specific ship in a specific place. We think that's, you know, that's a little bit more of a opportunity by opportunity or frame by frame kind of approach to the business, but we actually believe that keeps us a lot more engaged with our customer in terms of what's really driving their thinking in terms of the way they're using the products today and the way that they want to use them in the future and what they need to do for the products of the future. And I frankly believe that that's going to be where more and more of their business is going to be there. I mean, the Pacific Ocean, the Western Pacific, is a long ways away. And trying to find way, you know, to bring a ship from there all the way back to some place where you can do a depot-level maintenance is going to be something that's really tough. And you're going to have to find ways and more creative ways to do more maintenance on the go. And so we think that we're good at that. We've been doing it for a long time. We think that it's an opportunity for us going forward.
I had two questions. One is the $1.5 billion you outlined in terms of capital spending. Is that evenly spread? Is it front-end loaded, back-end loaded? How should we think about that?
I'll answer that one. Really, these are projects that we're in the process of Ingalls defining, and then, like Matt talked about, the APCO fixture, talked about upgrading all the welding equipment, things like that. It can fluctuate, okay? It can fluctuate over time. So I wouldn't, you know, I'd smooth it just for a look, and then each year we'll give you an update on where we are in our capital expenditures and what projects have been funded and all be spent during the year.
Okay. And then also, I know you don't want to necessarily talk about nearer term numbers, but if I think about 2016, you've talked a couple times about the pace of deliveries at Newport News and 3 deliveries in the first, I guess, through early 17. Does the delivery of the ship, does that cause your cash inflows to be higher when you're delivering ships? So even though revenues might be down during delivery periods, do you end up with better cash flow?
On fixed price incentive ships where there are retentions, the answer is yes, the cash will pop at delivery. Okay. On the Ford class, we have a very small retention, even though it was cost type, but it's not the size of a fixed price incentive retention. And then on the RCOH, that is also cost type, and there are no retentions on that ship. And same with the inactivation. So no big cash pop for any of those.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
you want to talk to that next?
Yeah. So I would first look to actually the 16 National Defense Authorization Act and language that is in that bill that actually talks about acceleration. It's something that the Congress has expressed an interest in, and so we'll see that language, hopefully, as I said earlier, the NDAA, once it's approved, hopefully today from the Senate and enacted, we'll have some language there. And then ultimately in 17, you know, this process will play out. And typically the process of acceleration, efficient production of ships, I mean, it's a multi-year type of a thing that will play out. So it'll be interesting to see how all this rolls forward. But I think the very first step is the interest of the Congress has articulated in the 16 legislation to explore these concepts. And I didn't mention it. I talked about LXR, LHA-8. There's also a language in the NDAA that talks about the efficiency of buying material from more than one carrier at a time. So all of these are in the context of getting more efficient and effective ship production.
Saying earlier that the free cash flow kind of averaged a little bit over one. I mean, this year it's probably going to be 150% helped by that 150% insurance payment you got. Last year was well above one. I forget with one time items it just the underperformed ship finishing. So going forward, is it fair to assume to expect free cash flow somewhere around one, excluding these events on gas bill would be an add-on to say the one free cash flow?
Well, so what you have to remember is Avondale got priced in the rates for the ships, okay? So that recovery occurs within the rates of the Ingalls ships. I would say over a period of time, you can look at cash conversion as a one. It just don't look at it on a quarter and don't look at it yearly because timing can make it swing.
Yeah, please
message.
Don't do that. This lumpy thing gets her really agitated. So.
And then just a quick one. What would you figure to do the normal dilution going forward?
From a share repurchase?
Yeah.
So I think you're not going to like my answer. I know you won't. But it depends. We will be doing some opportunistic share repurchases, and it really just depends on timing, George. So I don't want to commit to what the dilution should be.
Okay.
Yeah. A follow-up on your leverage and where you're willing to go, just to kind of understand the inputs and the history into that. Can you just share with us what the role of the government is in your relationship with the Navy? Do they weigh in on that leverage? Is that an input? And can you just remind us from a historical standpoint, I think you came out of the IPO, what level you were? Would you ever go back to that? What was their role in driving you down over the past couple of years?
Well, first of all, I'll start with the Navy's role at the very beginning. As we went through the spin process, the Navy was very engaged with us and with Northrop Grumman on just how do we get a balance sheet in place that will support their requirements. And they're, you know, as the principal customer of the business, they had a very strong view as to how you leverage the company to get it done. Now, it's not their main line of business, and so we had to do some education there, but in the main, if you think of it as three parties, the three parties came to a place that made good sense for everybody. And so after that, it's really been less from the Navy on terms of what kind of leverage do you have, and really more from them on do you have the flexibility and the capacity to make the investments that you need to make. And as long as you can do that, then they, and we've been able to do that, and this is, you know, we're telling you that we're making a very strong commitment to doing that going forward. The Navy, they may have an opinion, but they don't weigh in really in any sort of substantive way in terms of what your balance sheet ought to look like or anything like that. So
that's all to say that you could then, now that you've proven what you've done over the past couple of years, it's reasonable to say, you know, excluding the pension, that leverage level, you could get back to it, and they would be comfortable, you would be comfortable.
Yeah, I think it's really about, are we able to sustain our commitment to invest in their business? As long as we're able to continue to do that, you know, they'll be comfortable with whatever else we decide we want to do. Any other questions here? Wow. Well, again, I really appreciate the fact that you took the time to be here today and that you took an interest in our company. As I said at the beginning of this last section, I hope you realize that this is a company of substance. We're not all about sizzle. We're about the steak. We execute every single day. I hope you leave here with a sense that we're not only a substantive company, but we're a transparent company. We're going to tell you what's going on, good, bad, or indifferent. We're going to let you know what's going on. I hope you have confidence and trust that the team that's in place is the team that's going to make the best of whatever the situation is. So thanks for your attention and your participation today. It's been a great morning for us, and we look forward to seeing you out there on the street or in the shipyards. Come see us. Thank you very much.